House Committee on Health Care, Subcommittee on Health Policy to order.
I call the House Committee on Education to order.
And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2650. Welcome today. There is an overflow room for folks who don't have a place to sit, and I'm not sure what room that is. 343. You get to see us live in color in 343. Welcome today. We have a lot of people set up to testify, and want to welcome the House Committee on Education for joining us today. It's good to see you all.
Thanks for your hospitality.
You're welcome. We're looking at a bill today that connects health and education in a way that we wanted to make sure that we had both our education colleagues here as well as the Health Policy Subcommittee for this discussion today. And we're going to start off, Representative Brune and I are chief co-sponsors in the House. We're going to come up and start off the testimony. Our plan today is to hear from our colleagues in the Senate as well, and then we're going to have a couple of panels, one proponents of the bill, some opponents of the bill, so we can get some of the main arguments out for everyone here today. And then the second hour of today's hearing, we're going to open up for public testimony, and some people have already signed up. We will probably have overflow to Thursday's meeting. If you cannot return on Thursday and would like to testify in the second hour of today, if you could tell Aaron, our committee assistant, that you cannot come back, we will try to move you up to make sure you get here today. And all I would say is that when we get to that portion, if people could try to keep their comments as brief as possible so we can get as many people in today, that would be great. So, Chair Buckley, pass it off to you.
Thank you,
Representative Bonamici. Thank you.
If the committee administrator would remind us what this bill is all about.
Oh, that would be great while we're walking.
If the Sam, you need to get a microphone, we're going to come on up.
There you go.
Thank you.
Over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2650 is a bill that specifies minimum standards for food and beverages sold in public kindergarten through grade 12 schools. It allows the school district board to adopt more restrictive standards than are currently in place. And it declares an emergency and is effective on passage. At this time, there is no revenue impact on the bill. We have not received a fiscal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, representatives, thank you for stepping forward. Who's going to begin?
Bruno O'Donnell.
All right.
Bruno, this way? Okay. Well, thank you, colleagues. It's my honor to be here. I am Scott Bruin from House District 37, which is primarily Tualatin and West Lynn. And before I say anything, I just want to say and recognize with some huge thank yous to all the advocates that have helped put this together, from parents to nurses to healthcare advocates to teachers and even a couple kids out there who are supporting this at this point. I want to just, as everybody up there knows, it's a Herculean task, and lots of people have worked hard for a long time to make this come together. Committees, when we had the press conference on this a few weeks back, I invoked the name of my favorite president and talked about one of his passions, and that president was Theodore Roosevelt. I can't talk about anything, even peanut butter, without talking about Theodore Roosevelt, so I'll always find a way to work him in. But specifically as it relates to what we're talking about today, Theodore Roosevelt, who was president exactly 100 years ago today, advocated something called the strenuous life. He was a big believer in the life of activity and action and sweat and toil, and he lived that. He talked about it. He wrote about it. He lived that. And that was everything from mountain climbing to bodybuilding to rowing to hunting. In fact, he was the first, among the first, I should say, Americans to climb the Matterhorn. He did it on his honeymoon in the 1800s in Switzerland, of course. The strenuous life is something that I think that it was a real value of this country 100 years ago, and I'd have to say that sadly that's not where we are today. And 100 years later, in 2007, that those same sort of mindset, those same sort of precepts that guided Theodore Roosevelt and even guided this nation to a long degree are gone. Idly watching TV, playing video games, or surfing the internet would have been anathema to the Rough Rider. Yet these pursuits are too often the default mode for today's kids, and I totally understand that because these things are fun. I'm the first to admit I'm a TV junkie. I love to surf the internet, and I don't have any games, but a few of my buddies that do have some of these games, they're really cool. I mean, they're fun, and you can see why people can get addicted to spending 3 or 4 hours at a time doing that. Now, it's also no doubt that kids like to eat fatty, sugary, high-caloric food. Why do they like to do this? Because it tastes good. Who doesn't want a donut in a Mountain Dew? I mean, it's good stuff, at least to the palate. So I understand this well. These things taste good. But what we have here, ladies and gentlemen, is what I would call a perfect storm. We have an increasingly less active lifestyle, less healthy lifestyle, coupled with the fact that access to these sugary, fatty, high-caloric foods is that much easier. And we have, once again, a perfect storm, and I think that leads to the crisis that we have right now. We've all heard about this crisis. It's obesity, it's overweight in America. Right now, 65% of Americans are overweight. I'm talking about all Americans, not just children, but 65% of Americans are overweight. 31% are diagnosed as clinically obese. We're talking about kids, and so let's cut it down to the facts. In Oregon, 25% of our kids, 8th grade and older, are overweight, and below that, the figure is about 16%. This is more than doubled since the 1980s. What does this lead to? So what does that mean? And so we've got fatter kids, honestly. What's the problem? What does that mean? Lots of lifestyle, lots of health-related concerns with that. The thing that concerns me the most with that, and the thing that actually brought me to this bill as an advocate, is a epidemic, for lack of a better word, and I think it's an accurate word, an epidemic in type 2 diabetes among children. Now, years ago, children only used to get type 1 diabetes. I actually have type 1 diabetes. I'll share with you a few of the things that I do on a daily basis, just to sort of bring the point home. Type 1 diabetes was the purview of children. It's called juvenile onset diabetes, and that's because people generally got it when they were a kid, and it's a genetic issue. It could be an environmental issue. People don't really know exactly what causes type 1 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes, the science is a little better understood. Type 2 diabetes, with exceptions, is generally a lifestyle issue. It's a result. There's certainly a genetic predisposition. I'm sure there's people in the medical community that will hone it down better than I will. But it is a genetic predisposition, but it's also furthered by lifestyle. If you are out of shape, if you are overweight, your chances of acquiring type 2 diabetes as an adult is significantly higher. We're getting type 2 diabetes in epidemic proportions among kids. And once again, decades ago, this was unheard of. Kids didn't get type 2 diabetes. Kids got the kind of diabetes that I got. What's happening with this is just horrific when we consider the cost. These are the four kinds of insulins that I take. So there they are now. Syringes. This is the device I use to check my blood about 8 or 10 times a day. These things cost, and here's the test strips right here. These things cost 50 cents a piece. I do about 8 or 10 of these a day. Very extraordinarily expensive. And when you consider the cost of that, you consider the insulins that I use. Extraordinarily expensive. I am well controlled. I'm a low cost diabetic, for lack of a better way to describe it, because I try to do the things, knock on wood, I try to do the things that will limit the side effects. This is the best case scenario, folks, but this is not what we're seeing with our kids. We're seeing the conditions that lead to type 2 diabetes, and we're seeing this as just the start. The costs involved with type 2 diabetes from childhood through adulthood are staggering, not only what they do to private lives and families, but what it does to the public health care, the monies we spend on public health care. When we talk about the complications of heart disease and blindness and potential amputations because of circulatory problems to kidney problems to diabetic retinopathy in the eyes, The downside chronic potentials with this are just frightening, and our kids are getting this. That is why I support 2650. It's not a cure-all. Nothing is. A cure-all would be a way to get our kids out of the houses and into the backyards playing, eating healthy foods, probably a little higher degree of personal responsibility when it comes to taking care of ourselves. We're not going to get that with this bill, but we get a good step of the way there with ensuring that our kids, when they're in the classroom, have access to the kinds of foods that are healthy. They're the right balance of sugar or not too much sugar. They're the right the right number of calories. They're the right proportion of fat to carbohydrate and protein. These are the things that not only serve our kids well in school from a nutritional standpoint, but also help to educate our kids as they go from one grade to another and finally get out of school. We're starting a lifetime of education here with 2650 and what it will do for schools. Now, I've heard a lot of people talk about, well, but you're taking away choice, and I'm the first to tell you, absolutely, we are taking away choice. I would never suggest that we take away choice for an adult. Being an adult presupposes that you have maturity and education and intelligence and all that. I'm not going to give that luxury to a child. I want parental controls in school, even if this parent can't be there with my child. And I have a child. She would take every opportunity to eat exactly the things I don't want her to eat. And Natalie, if you're watching, yes, I'm talking about you. I want the ability to have some sort of parental control when I'm not there. And we could say, well, we should let schools take care of that. We can't have teachers and administrators. They don't have the time and the resources to manage what every single little individual student is popping in their mouth or what they're getting in the lunch tray. This is a step for us parents and us adults in Oregonian to finally say, listen, we got to cut to the chase on this in schools. We've got to have a little bit of that parental control, if you will, when the kids are in school. And when the kids get home, if they want to get jacked up on Mountain Dew and Ding Dongs, that's the parents' God-given right, and God bless them. But while they're in school, they need to eat a little bit better. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Representative. Senator?
Thank you very much. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, and I will be very brief. I have a committee meeting that I need to get to. This is the third session that I worked on this bill, and Senator Berger is in the committee that I'm going to and is not able to be here. It's been very frustrating, and there are a couple of things that we have tried to overcome. One is to persuade the distributors that we're not going to take away their profitability. We're trying to persuade the education administrators that they still will make money. The companies can put healthy food in the machines. The money will flow. The other concern that I have is this is a developmental age of particularly middle school kids. That's what I'm focusing on. The elementary kids, I think, are okay. They have pretty healthy food. They don't have machines. Middle school are when the habits are formed. High school, they have open campus, and it's hard to control. But what we want to provide are the healthy foods that districts have not, some of the districts have not solved that problem. Now, wellness reports were made by every district, supposedly. Some districts didn't do the wellness report. There are some very good ones. 4J and Eugene is a good one. Springfield is a good one. Some of them are wish lists. Some of them are just repetitions of what the feds have said, but there are no sideboards. And so what I'm hoping we can do is put some sideboards, put a floor on the where healthy foods have to be above that line. And it can be done without a lot of disruption either to the students' taste, to the parents, and to the school district. So I'm very excited now that we have a lot of enthusiasm, and we're hearing the bill on the House side first, and I think that we are gaining momentum, and I am extremely pleased. So thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Senator. Representative.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, Vice Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. For the record, I am Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. I'll be brief. I'm very happy to be here. This is an exciting day for kids in the state, and I want to thank Senator Morrison and Senator Berger for their leadership. This is the third session that we've been looking at a bill like this, and frankly, it's about time we pass one. Lots has changed in the national landscape, in the state landscapes in 2003 when we had the first version of this bill. This is a very modest, implementable bill. I'm here because, as you know, I've been a child advocate for many years. In 2005, when I was at Children First for Oregon, we did a report on childhood obesity, and the number one recommendation was we need statewide school nutrition standards. We know, as Representative Bruce mentioned, we have a large public health issue in the state, whether it's diabetes, obesity. This bill is going to get us some of a strong tool that we need to help students have healthier choices in the schools. It's the right thing to do. And from my point of view, it's also the socially just thing to do. Every student in this state, regardless of where they live, regardless of the resources of their schools or the level of activism from their parents, every student in this state should have access to healthy choices in the schools. This is a public health issue. That's why we need statewide standards. So I urge you to support this bill, and I look forward to the rest of the testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, members. With the exception of Teddy Roosevelt's honeymoon, any questions for these representatives? Seeing none, thank you both very much for your testimony. Vice Chair Bonamici, do you have the list of folks who are coming?
There it is.
I'll wait for Representative Kotek to come up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Our first panelists will be Mary Lou Henrich and Amanda Purcell. And on deck, we have Nancy Becker and Paresh Patel. Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Kotek, members of the Health Policy Subcommittee, and also Chair Buckley and members of the House Education Committee for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2650. For the record, my name is Mary Lou Henrich. I'm a public health nurse and currently serve as the Executive Director of Community Health Partnership, Oregon's Public Health Institute. I'm here today as a founding member of the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance. Our group includes many organizations such as the American Diabetes Association, Oregon Nurses Association, Oregon Health Sciences University, Kaiser Permanente, Oregon Medical Association, Stanford Children, Dietetics Association, Heart Association, PTA, and others. You will hear from several representatives of our alliance this afternoon as we try to give you an overview of what 2650 is and an explanation of why we believe it is a moderate, common-sense approach to address Oregon's childhood obesity epidemic that you've already heard about. We will also point out the similarities of this bill with laws recently enacted in California and being implemented, and we've brought Amanda Purcell from California up to talk and be able to you can ask her questions about how is it working. We will also let you hear perspectives from a school nutrition director, snack food vendor, parents, students, public health, medical, and nutrition experts. And we will give you a bit of background on the significance and costs of the childhood obesity epidemic, why this is so important to act, and the moral imperative to do the right thing for all Oregon children. I think, as Representative Kotek said, we need to make school environments one that make the healthy choice the easy choice. So I'm going to give you a quick overview and tell you specifically what the bill does and does not do. First, the bill sets nutrition standards for all foods sold in schools. Those are foods sold outside the National School Meals Program that already have federal standards. It follows the same nutritional standards as were put into the California law, with one exception. We put no trans fat. When they were doing their law, trans fat wasn't as big an issue, so we took care of that one. We also established reasonable standards for individual entrees that are not sold as part of a USDA school meal. So in the cafeteria, when there is an a la carte line, foods that are sold on that, not part of the regular unitized meal. We recognize that some school districts have current beverage contracts. This bill requires them to comply with the new law standards to the extent that is allowed under their existing contracts. After enactment of the law, new contracts or contract extensions must comply with these new standards. But that is, we are not breaking contracts that are currently in existence. It also makes the school environment a role model and consistent with what is being taught in the classroom. So we indeed say schools will sell what they tell. Now, what does it not do? House Bill 2650 does not change or modify the current federal nutrition standards for the National School Lunch Program. We don't mess with that. Whether you'd like to or not, this bill doesn't do it. We do not ban the sale of snack foods or beverages. We do not keep schools from contracting with vendors for beverage or snack food sales. It simply changes the product mix of what is sold to healthier choices. And it does not, despite what you may hear later, create an unfunded mandate, because it doesn't jeopardize revenue used by schools for a variety of needed programs and services, because many districts across the country, and Amanda can speak to this too, have found that the sale of more nutritious products either retains or actually has increased revenue. That's when you make healthy and healthier choices available rather than kind of the bad choice. And then, oh, would you like a piece of broccoli? Probably not. So a bit on the history and background. The concept of getting junk foods out of schools, as you heard, was first raised in 2003 when Senator Morissette introduced a bill. In the 2005 session, Senators Morissette and Senator Joanne Verger each introduced bills with similar intents. And unlike this session, there was not sufficient political will to see them passed. So what's happened between then and now? Why do we think we have more of a chance now to maybe get this law through? One is that I think that you, policymakers, and the public have come to understand that we do have a crisis of childhood obesity. Last session, I was having trouble kind of getting people's attention on this. I think it's really in the public eye.
I think that we also have a difference. We have implemented the federal school district local wellness policy mandate. That was looming, and a lot of people hoped that that would kind of take care of the problem. Each district would do the right thing. And, in fact, the Oregon School Board Association, the Department of Ed, and many members of the Nutrition Policy Alliance worked to assist local school districts in the development of meaningful local wellness policies. Our organization assisted the Department of Ed, and we presented more than a dozen local wellness policy workshops across the state, from Pendleton to Klamath Falls to Coos Bay, Lincoln City, Portland Metro, all around the state. Over 350 people attended those workshops. Yet, after the wellness policies were turned into the Department of Ed, and we received copies of them under public law filing, we found in looking at them and reviewing them that less than 20%, that was 34 out of 174 that were turned in, even mentioned anything specific about nutrition standards. Many of them just said, let's encourage our kids to eat well. We encourage activity. It didn't put any specifics around it. So our assessment is that many of Oregon's school districts are small and under-resourced. These districts do not have the resources to provide leadership on such a technical issue that's outside the usual scope of education, and also may not have had a parent or community resources to focus the amount of time and effort it takes to lead this type of complex policy development process. So I think now that many of the state policymakers and locals, too, agree that enactment of statewide nutrition standards is really needed to protect all of Oregon's children. Another change, the food and beverage industries have agreed to voluntary snack food and beverage nutrition guidelines in an agreement with President Clinton's Alliance for a Healthier Generation. And in fact, our guidelines are very similar to those voluntary standards. We just want to make sure they're happening. The food and beverage industry has also developed new products, repackaged products into smaller sizes. Don't know if you've seen like Nabisco's 100-calorie packs. They're flying off the shelf in the grocery store. People are buying them. These products will allow schools to continue to raise revenue by selling foods in smaller portion sizes that meet the bill standards, and we'll be showing you today some of those foods are. Also, many other individuals and organizations have, since the last 2 years, kind of realized the reasonableness of statewide nutrition standards and pledged their support. So this time we've got Oregon PTA, Stand for Children, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, the nurses, physicians, dentists have all joined with last time's Public Health, Diabetes, and Cancer Associations to make passage of Health Bill 2650 one of their top legislative priorities for this session. We also held many stakeholder meetings over the past 2 years to receive input and shape the final version of our bill. Numerous efforts have been made to reach agreeable compromises with such groups as the school food service directors and industry representatives that have opposed statewide nutrition standards in the past. We understand that it is human nature to resist change and not want to be told what to do. But we must not lose sight of the stakes and the main objective, the health and well-being of Oregon's children. When the protection of health and safety of Oregon's children is at stake, statewide school policy and law has been the answer in many instances, such as in smoking policy, bullying, and statewide immunization requirements. Thank you for the opportunity to address you. I'm glad to answer any questions, but I think some of them may be answered in the next testimonies, and Chair Kotek can do it however she wants to. We thank you for giving the bill the consideration it deserves, and we know you join us in the many efforts needed to make Oregon's children healthier and better able to learn. I'd now like to introduce Amanda Purcell from the California Center for Public Health Advocacy. Amanda traveled to Portland today, or to Salem today. She did go to Portland first. And then came down in the rain to give you an overview of California's law and its implementation.
Thank you, Mary Lou. And if we could do the two panelists and then take questions, and then probably what we'll do is we'll take questions from the Education Committee and then do the Health Policy Committee. We'll kind of go back and forth. But Amanda.
Right. Thank you. Again, my name is Amanda Purcell, and I'm the Policy Director for the California Center for Public Health Advocacy. It's an honor to be with you this afternoon to participate in your dialogue on school nutrition. My organization was the sponsor of the three pieces of legislation in California which put competitive food and beverage standards into place. Our standards, as you've already heard, are very similar to the ones that you're discussing here today. I'd like to share information from our effort that affirms that the standards in 2650 are the right thing to do for Oregon's children, and to talk with you briefly about the coalition of groups which work together on our pieces of legislation. California's work to improve school food began in 1999 and was born out of the same realization that you've had here, that we were facing a growing youth obesity epidemic, and we needed to make it easier for children to make healthy food choices at school. The competitive food standards that were placed in our bill and are reflected in yours came from a national consensus panel that was convened by my organization in 1999. The panel included experts from the United States Department of Agriculture, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the California Dietetics Association, the California Department of Education, Children's Hospital Los Angeles, as well as university researchers and school food service directors. The standards were subsequently adopted by USDA in 2004 for its Healthier U.S. Schools Challenge. The set of standards you have before you today is well vetted, and they are based in science. Experts across the country have declared these standards to be a good starting point for improving the nutritional quality of food sold to children at school. California took a big step when it started changing the type of food and beverages sold to children at school, and we're beginning to see the effects from that change. I have a couple of examples for you. Dr. William McCarthy, a professor at UCLA, recently looked at the effect the standards have at the elementary school level. At post-test, children in the schools that he looked at that had implemented the standards had a significantly smaller waist circumference than children at the schools without the standards. The schools with the standards also reported higher school lunch participation and in some cases showed greater increases in standardized test scores than the control schools. The UC Berkeley Center for Weight and Health found that the schools implementing the standards, even high schools, saw increased participation in the school meal program and the ability of schools to transition children away from competitive snack food lines into full balanced meal programs, which is often what nutrition advocates are looking for. The Los Angeles Unified School District, which eliminated soda sales in 2002 and put nutrition standards into place in 2004, has successfully made those changes work. Students still have snacks and beverages to buy in Los Angeles, but they're a little healthier than they were before, and they still have plenty of school programs that are being funded in Los Angeles Unified. And I always like to note that Los Angeles Unified has approximately 750,000 children in that district. It is our biggest district in the state. So finally, to note, as it seems to be across the nation, school nutrition reform was a very contentious issue in California. It took us multiple legislative attempts, as it has here in Oregon, to build consensus on the need for change. At the beginning of our effort, some of our most vocal opponents were the California School Nutrition Association, the California School Boards Association, and the Association of California School Administrators. But this was not the case when the bills were finally signed by the governor. In the end, we were joined by the California School Boards Association in sponsorship of the standards bill, and both the school administrators and the School Nutrition Association testified in support of the bill and made legislative visits in support of the bill. You might wonder what caused this change. It was simply a change of perspective. Our groups and the other 80 organizations that supported the reform effort decided to put the health of children at the core of our decision making. The education groups in particular decided that they were no longer willing to stand in opposition to providing healthier foods to children. They acknowledged that change might be difficult, but they opted to spend their energy figuring out how to make the policy work instead of killing it. In fact, the California School Boards Association has received national recognition for the work it has done on behalf of school nutrition reform and the training it provides for school boards related to nutrition policy. In closing, I would like to recommend passage of 2650. We found in California that school nutrition reform was simply the right thing to do for children. I believe you will find that it's the right thing to do for children in Oregon as well. Again, thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you, Mr. Amanda, just the question comes to mind. Thank you for being here. Thanks for your testimony. When you mentioned the Los Angeles Unified School District, which is obviously a large sample. Do you have dollar figures? Because I know that will come up. It will come up and say, you know, we're going to lose money on this. Mm-hmm. Dollar figures on the difference between.
You know, there's a couple things that I think we saw in districts across the state, both in small districts as well. That a lot of times what happens is when the standards go into place, you'll see a dip in sales to begin with. So it would not be unlike what you would expect in any marketplace. When you change the product mix, it takes customers, children are customers, a chance to figure out what are the products I like, which ones are the ones I'm going to substitute. In many cases, after that period of adjustment, we saw, as you've already heard, we saw sales go up above where they were before. So if the products are selected well, so particularly involving students in the selection of the products that are going to go in, making sure that they're priced well, that they're marketed well, and that it's given time to for the school environment to adjust to it, children adjust. We had a board member on from the Los Angeles Unified School District who made the comment, if people are thirsty and they have orange juice to drink, they're going to drink orange juice. So, you know, I think we have to remember that we're talking about very modest changes with these standards. We're talking about getting rid of really the worst offenders. And as you're going to see in a little while, the foods that can be sold at school under these standards are things that kids love to buy. We're not talking about brown rice, tofu, steamed vegetables, and some but you're going to see that these are very kid-friendly products. There's a wide range of kid-friendly products that are available that have a little less sugar and a little less fat, a little less calories, and those little changes we know from nutrition science are really good for kids.
Representative Dolan.
Yes, thank you, Chair Buckley. And thank you for the first question. It allows me to chalk one up. When this program was implemented, the vending machines become obvious. The student store and the concession stand at athletic contests, that sort of thing, are they included in this program also?
The Representative Kotek, Representative Buckley, Representative Dellum, yes, no. Actually, let me tell you the ones that are and the ones that aren't. This is during school hours, and when the it would be an after school program where it is aimed at the children. So if there is choir practice or there's things like that that go on after school, then indeed the school store and the vending machines would need to be selling the product that's healthy. When we get into concession stands that are at a game or something like that, they are not included because the law says that those have a lot of adults there too. So I think that we're trying to do moderate steps, and that is to say during the school day and any time there's a before school activity or an after school activity that's really the students on campus and it's just on the school grounds, then the standards would be in place, but not with the games and the booster clubs and that kind of thing.
Thank you very much.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Hendridge,
yes.
Thank you for your testimony. And I go back to Senator Morissette made a comment. The plain fact is the state now pays the bulk of the local school's bill, so it's our duty to do something. But we're not consistent in applying that. I have some things in my school district I want to force down, but I don't have a lot of support for that. So this is, you know, so we go back and forth on that. But my question to you is you talked about in your testimony that the federal mandate did not work, but it only started in 2006. And also, I think the President Clinton's Alliance for a Healthier Generation only just started. And have we really given, you know, those voluntary efforts a chance to succeed?
Representative Kotek Buckley, Representative Wisnett.
You can just say chairs.
Okay,
say
chairs. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jules. I think you will hear some more testimony as we go along about the local wellness policies in particular. And the fact that, yes, it was just the first time, but we've got an epidemic on our hands, and the effort that it took to get to, in our estimation, the review of those policies, the majority of them, over 75%, really don't say anything particular. So it's like that was the result of 2 years of amazing efforts, and some districts came out with some really good ones, but it was a relatively small group. So we're thinking with the epidemic that how long do we wait around? And the second thing, and also that districts, this does not preclude them from going far beyond, and you'll hear from Portland District today, they've gone far beyond what this floor is. This is just the floor. So I would say we want the wellness policy work at the local level to continue. We would just like that social justice that Representative Kotek talked about, where in some districts where they don't have the time, energy, or expertise, that it gets done. On your other question about the American Beverage Association, President Clinton, voluntary standards, our standards are very similar to those standards. We simply want to make sure that they get in place and happen, because as it is now with those standards, if you read the Memorandum of Understanding, the school district needs to really approach the vendors, the Pepsi, Coke, Cadbury, Schweppes, and we're saying, let's just say this is it, and especially as you start to renew those contracts, that we be sure that the product mix is what we should have in schools.
Nicole, thank you. I appreciate those comments again, and I go back to my school district, and we talk about spending the money. The state's giving the districts most of that money. I have a school district that has a nutritionist, so can we get rid of that nutritionist?
Chairs, Representative Wood said, never get rid of the nutritionist. I'm a nurse.
So we're mandating from the state level.
Well, there are still many things that need to be done around the school food service program, and the nutritionist at this moment in most of the districts really doesn't have a lot to do with the vending machines or the school stores, which is what this really attacks. They really have to do with the federal school lunch program. Breakfast.
Representative Kopp?
First of all, I want to thank the chairs and Representative Boone for bringing this forward. just two comments, and I wish that we could make a whole other layer of recommendation, and that's, you know, about what students can have on birthdays and Valentine's Day. And if anybody has any doubt in their mind about whether this type of intake impacts learning, please come to a middle school the week after Halloween. And I'm serious. They do not sit down for a week. And it's like a whole week of learning is lost because of they just have this bag of junk that they continue to consume. And so thank you for your efforts.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Wilburn.
I also want to thank you, Chairs, for this bill. I have a wife who's an elementary principal, and this is one of her passions, so I understand that. But I want to say I wish you'd take on the federal standards for their lunches, too. It is not conscionable to say we're going to put these better things in our vending machines and what we sell than what we give kids on a daily basis that don't have any choice with what they're going to eat. And it frustrates me that we have sugar cereal being served all around this country to kids and all that kinds of things. And so that's another thing. If we're really going to try to change dieting, we need to do some other things, and I would hope that people would consider that. However, and this is my other part and the question. Having been a high school principal, we get constantly beat up by not meeting academic standards. This one does go to academic standards, and I think you made a good point about nutrition, foods, and whatever. But public schools, since the 1950s, have been the place where every social problem is solved. And they don't get credit for solving them. I mean, you know, we don't have an evaluation that says because of public schools and the requirement that immunization happens, we have less disease today than we had before. We just pile it on and get one more person that has to be hired to follow through that we do all of those things, whether it's homelessness or whether, I mean, all of the things are good, but you lose track of what the focus is of what schools are supposed to do, which is educate children. And I guess from my perspective, keep pushing, and I guess I would ask you one more time, and my question is, you know, the connection between nutrition and academic performance, because I know it's there, and I just want to make sure that that is clearly stated, because one more thing that schools have to be accountable for that doesn't go back to their mission is really frustrating to me.
Yeah. Chairs, Representative Roblin, I hear you. My daughter is a teacher, and she brings home some of these same concerns. I think that some of these studies that are coming out that are really looking at that link between what kids eat and how they perform. And I think that I heard Amanda reference that in the UCLA study, I think, that said that they're finding actually some standardized test scores that are improving. And I totally second your word that we need to thank the schools of Oregon and of the United States of America for doing the wonderful job that they do, and that society oftentimes just dumps at their doorstep without much thanks. And I, as a parent of a teacher, I recognize that, and I thank all of you who've done that.
Sorry, I don't know the protocol here, so I'll just acknowledge you all.
We all feel
don't do that in California. It's kind of funny. I would just add that actually the California School Boards Association has a great publication they've put out called Healthy Kids Ready to Learn, and it's the whole justification about why the link between nutrition and learning. And it's a document, a really nice document for school board members, laying out why is it that you should care as a school board member about nutrition, and then guides them kind of through the policy making process. And our bill was signed at the same time the local wellness policy process started in California. So all our local wellness policies contain our state law, because those two things happened at the same time. So the School Boards Association has been great about helping districts to integrate the new state law into their local policy making as well. So I just refer you to that document if you'd like to see a really nice, concise statement about nutrition and learning.
And maybe we could get at least maybe the executive summary of that for all.
That would be great.
Back to you.
Do either of my other committee, education committee members, we're going to grant an education person to pass over to health care. Representative Greenlee?
See, I can go either way.
Who else would you?
We got Representative Cam down there.
You know, I really support this very much, but a couple of our medical students did a study in a couple of the high schools in Portland, in the Portland area. And in looking at the quartile of young women in the high school who were the least weight for height, about half of them viewed themselves as being too fat. And I wonder the extent to which, as we worry about the obesity epidemic, which is a tsunami approaching us, that we safeguard, the extent to which we safeguard against the other extreme as we're dealing with the educational components around the food choices, and that we make sure we're sufficiently worrying about anorexia and bulimia at the same time we're worrying about obesity. Is that a part of the thought process in this?
Chairs and Representative Greenlick, I think that's a very good point, and I think that when maybe Nancy Becker comes up as our dietitian, she can speak to this. She is a clinical dietitian. But the other piece is that I think that by changing the environment, the total environment, and saying there are only going to be healthy choices available, but many choices within that, it really changes the environment. It isn't singling out individual students talking about, you need to eat this and you need to eat that. It really is simply making the environment one where the healthy choice is the easy choice, and then definitely this is not going to take care of anorexia and bulimia, but I think it doesn't stigmatize. It's not something that's targeted at specific kids, and it isn't. I just think that we're putting healthy foods available to them.
Representative, middle school teacher.
Well, I didn't have my hand up, Chair, but I think that's something to say. My wife is a teacher, and she teaches in a portable classroom in a high school that doesn't have drinking fountains. So the students bring to her classroom the beverages that they're able to get in a container, which come out of a vending machine. There is water in that vending machine, however, there are also soft drinks, and very often the preferred alternative is soft drink, but very often it isn't. So the students look for a water option. The water is the first to go, in fact, out of the vending machine, and it's the last to be restocked. So I'm wondering how much I should say here. I don't want to get my wife in trouble. She has made water available to her students, and finds that they're picking that up in droves. I mean, she cannot keep her classroom stocked with bottled water. I wonder. I obviously fully support this bill. I wonder why our schools are in, and this is largely a rhetorical question because I sort of know the answer, But I wonder why our schools are in the business of selling vending machine products to students. And why is water not made available, good, clean drinking water, in every classroom or at least every section of a building in the state? And I just pose that, you know, largely rhetorically, yes. I realize the cost drivers and the finances that are at work here, but it is just a poor reflection on this institution, on this body, and the way we fund education in this state, that our students are forced to pick from a vending machine, pay a dollar or more for a bottle in order to have something, bring something to drink to their classroom. So,
thank you, Representative.
Thank you. I had thank you, Representative Flores, and then Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Picking up on the thought that Representative Roblin was mentioning, and that's the connection to the USDA lunch program and the breakfast program, there's really so very much connection between, we already know, between learning and nutrition. So we're starting out our students with something that isn't even approached by this bill in the morning with their breakfast, because they don't have to meet the nutritional standards set here. How do you see that you're going to be able to have some positive impact?
Chair, Representative Flores, I think that when Christy Obink, who is the Director of Nutrition Services for Portland Public Schools, gets up to testify in a little while, she can probably address this better than I can. But I think our point is that we may not think that the standards that the federal government has laid out for the breakfast and lunch program are adequate. I mean, I hear a lot of that from parents and a lot of concerns from teachers. I don't feel I'm qualified to really speak to that, whether they are or they aren't. I hear a lot of arguments both sides. But I do think that that schools, part of the problem is, I don't know if you are aware, that Oregon is one of only two states in the whole union, the other being Alaska, that puts no state general fund into the meals program, breakfast or lunch program. Every other state, California, I think, gets 15 cents or maybe more per lunch or breakfast served. Oregon doesn't do that. So the food service directors are definitely between the rock and the hard place, trying to make their program come out in the black, not take any general school funds, and to really serve good, nutritious foods. But there are school food service people in this room who can speak much more eloquently to this. But I would put a pitch in that we need to think about adequately funding them so that they can more fruits and vegetables, things that are more expensive than some of the processed, you know, sugary foods. But there are standards, federal government standards, for those breakfasts and lunch, whether you really want to believe it or not, there are.
Quick follow-up. Thank you. I hope someone from the Beaverton School District is here, because it's my recollection that they were one of the few school districts that operate in the black as far as their nutrition program. And a lot of that was because of the training of who their then head of their kitchen or their department was, by virtue of his training as a chef.
Mm-hmm. Representative Bonamici?
Thank you. I also appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion about this incredibly important issue, and I do applaud everyone for addressing what I understand is a very significant issue with childhood obesity. That being said, I have some practical questions, and I'm so glad Ms. Purcell is here, because I would like to know about some of the issues of actually implementing, as I read through some very specific things in the bill. Now, I represent the Beaverton School District primarily. I have one sliver of my district is in the Portland School District. But in the Beaverton School District, as is maybe true in other districts, there are some K-8 schools and there are some 6-12 schools. And so in a K-8 school, do they get 150 calories or do they get 180 calories? And in the grades 6 through 12 school, do they have separate lines for snacks for the middle school students and the high school students? And just practically, how is that implemented if they aren't within the grades that are set out in this bill?
Yeah, we don't have that situation.
Chairs and Representative Bonamici, I think this is an item that we certainly would be open to figuring out. If you really look at the difference in the standards, and I think, again, Nancy Becker can speak to this when she comes up, they're just slightly lower caloric differences. And
you know, I've heard Nancy say that, you know, 20 or 40 calories is not, you know, going to kill us here. So I think that probably we could work out so that the schools that have K to 8, that they maybe go with the middle school one, although that we really haven't had that discussion, but we're open to that.
Yeah, I don't know how you craft your legislation here, but ours has a, at the beginning, has a definition section where it defines each of the school types and kind of associates which part goes with which part. So it solves that problem, and I think it would be a fairly easy wording issue to deal with.
That's something that when we're thinking about passing legislation, and I know that the schools are looking at this saying there's going to be a lot to comply with, I would feel comfortable if that issue were addressed. Can I do a follow-up?
Yes.
It's not related. It's a separate question. I've heard a lot of comments so far about healthy choices. Believe me, applaud that. I think it's really important. But as I read the bill, in high school, the students can buy diet soda, which is artificially colored, artificially flavored, artificially sweetened beverage. And so what message, if we're sending to them saying we want this to be healthy food, I'm the kind of person who I rarely drink soda, and my kids don't either, but when they do, I get the real stuff and have that on occasion. What message are we sending that we're saying that artificially flavored, artificially colored, artificially sweetened fizzy water is healthy?
Chairs and Representative Bonamici, I think you raise a good question. A lot of the advocates, we debated and argued these things. We tried, however, to look at the fact that we were attacking obesity and that the diet products really add no calories. And so that was kind of the thing that pushed us over to, as well as the American Beverage Association voluntary agreement does allow the diet sodas at the high school level. So we were trying to find something that was kind of doable, reasonable, and a middle-of-the-road approach. It's not perfect.
Thank you. One more brief follow-up.
Parents, they get the extra.
Thank you. That was a good segue. You mentioned the individual serving size packages, and I won't even get into the whole environmental impact of all the individual serving and packaging, but I just wanted to mention that I was actually reading this bill with my daughter last night. She's a sophomore in high school. And when we got to the part about the individual serving sizes, she looked at me with she didn't say, but she had the doll look on her face. She said, "Mom, they'll just buy two or three." And so, I mean, obviously we're not going to get to the point where we're telling students how many they can buy, but I guess my point in saying that is we can't look at this as solving the issues, because we're still going to have kids who are bringing the liters of Coke in their backpack and walking across the street to the 7-Eleven for the super giant big gulps. So to me, I think that especially at the high school level, we just need to work on education and making sure that the student, they're going to be faced with choices a lot at the high school level. And if they can't make a healthy choice by the time they're in high school, and we haven't addressed the problem. I don't have any problem at all with the elementary and middle school, and I don't think that's, except for maybe the Representative Kromp is gone, the parties and that kind of thing. I don't think that's where the problem is necessarily. I don't have any problem with that. But when you get to high school, I really think that we need to be teaching our students how to make healthy choices. And yes, I think we should have the healthy food there. But boy, they need to be able to make those choices, because they're going to be faced with them throughout their lives. So that wasn't really a question, but more of a let's not forget about the education.
Chairs and Representative Bonamici, I think that, you know, we totally agree that we aren't going to be regulating all their choices. They have many more choices to go off campus, do other kinds of things. I think what we're believing is that I have a friend who couldn't be here today who's a health ed teacher, and what he said is, you know, I'm in there talking about nutrition, trying to teach the right thing, and they're paying me, you know, a good salary to do this. And he says, and then they walk outside the door, and there is the vending machine or the school store full of all this other stuff. And he said, a picture's worth a thousand words. So what is it doing when we're selling something different than what we're telling? Are we giving an inconsistent message? So the fact is, I believe they will go other places. I have kids, at 32 and a 27-year-old, and I understand this. But I think the main thing is the schools giving that consistent message.
We had the same, obviously, discussion in California, and what we decided was we teach children a lot by what we model to them, and a lot of the conversation that we have in the nutrition community is about portion distortion. So, you know, a bagel used to be this big, and now it's this big, and so, you know, we have bags of chips for sale that are this big. Somehow we get the impression that that's a single serving size. We teach kids a lot by modeling what an appropriate serving size is. So when we sell a bag of chips that looks like this and that's a single serving size, yeah, they can opt to eat more than one serving, but at least we're sending a subtle modeling message that this is really the appropriate size, not this.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thanks for being here today. Greatly
Thank
appreciate
you very
it.
Much.
Chair Kotek.
You're going to go out of line. I just want to say I gave a lot of latitude for the first panel because I think people have a lot of questions and want to get some initial things off and running, which I think is great. But we probably try to move along as best we can. I'm going to jump ahead of the proposed next panel and have Dr. Goldberg and Dr. Cohn from DHS, because I know that they have schedules that have taken a few minutes out of their day to come join us. So thank you, gentlemen.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Department of Human Services. I know you've had a lot of testimony. I will try and be brief. In fact, what I'm going to do is tell you a story, because you're going to hear a lot today, a lot of information about obesity, health, calories, dollars, legislation, regulation, et cetera, and you will no doubt hear about an epidemic of obesity, the fact that we're getting bigger as a state. You'll hear about the fact that 1 in 10 11th graders are overweight, about the fact that over 300,000 people in the United States died because of obesity. You'll hear about the hundreds of billions of dollars that we spend each year on obesity-related illness.
For the record, could you introduce yourself for those you might not know?
I thought I did, but I will again. Bruce Goldberg, I'm the director of the Department of Human Services.
Thank you.
That's okay. And
can I
just want to make sure.
Did you say 1 in 10?
1 in 10. I believe that it's over 1 in 10 11th graders are overweight and increasing.
I thought it's much more than that. But.
You will, as I had indicated, Representative Greenlicht, you'll hear a lot of statistics.
I believe it's there's the at-risk of overweight and the actual overweight.
Oh.
I'm going to leave the difficult questions to Mel. because I think it's easy to talk about the statistics, and it's easy to describe the problem. It's harder to move towards solutions. And I'm here today to neither speak about the problem nor the specifics of the solution, but really to talk about what I think is the moral imperative of preventing obesity. And to do that, as I said, I'd like to tell a little story. And it's actually a story that will probably be familiar to Representative Greenlicht, because it's a story well known in the public health world. And it's a story by a gentleman by the name of Irving Zola, who was a well-known American sociologist. And he developed what was really a compelling metaphor to describe, I think, a lot of the major healthcare problems facing us as a country. And the story goes like this. And it's told in his first person. And he says, "There I am standing by a shore of a swiftly flowing river, and I hear the cry of a man drowning downstream. So I jump into the river, put my arms around him, pull him to shore, and apply artificial resuscitation. And just when he begins to breathe, there's another cry for help. So I jump in the river, reach in, pull the next man out, apply artificial resuscitation, and then just as he begins to breathe, there's another cry for help. And he repeats the same scenario, again with the same sequence of events. And in the end, he concludes that he is so busy jumping in and pulling people to shore and applying artificial resuscitation that he has no time to see who is upstream pushing them all in. And I think the story is really indicative of the issue in front of us. Clearly, we have many children falling, slipping, tripping, being pushed into the stream, and there is no single solution. It's going to take a complex series of interventions to keep everybody from slipping, tripping, falling into the stream. House Bill 2650, I think, provides a common sense and a measured approach to being able to start keeping people from ending up at the bottom of the river. Thank you.
Chair Kotek, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Public Health Division, and it's a pleasure to be here and add my voice to the chorus that you've heard some of and you're going to continue to hear in the rest of the hearing today in support of this bill. In my opinion, the problem of childhood obesity is one of the leading public health problems that we face, not only here in Oregon, but in the United States as a whole. And I think this bill is an important step forward in that regard. You have my written testimony. I'm not going to go through it in great detail. The primary thing that I wanted to add to some of the scientific information that you're going to hear, and yes, Representative Greenlich, I believe that it's 1 in 4 of eighth graders is either overweight or at risk of overweight here in Oregon. So it's a huge, no pun intended, a huge problem for us. The one additional thing that I wanted to add that you may not hear from some of the other players is to make this committee aware of a study that we undertook, the results of which have not yet been released, and I brought the proofs. They haven't quite gone to the printer yet, but at the request of the governor's office and with some work by Dr. Goldberg and Senator Devlin as well, we put together an expert panel to look at the problem of childhood obesity here in Oregon, building on the work that Representative Kotek referred to that her group had done. And what we wanted to do was to look at not only what is the problem here, but what do we know about interventions to prevent the problem. As Dr. Goldberg said, there isn't a single fix to this, and you all have noticed have noted various other pieces of this problem. You know, it's not just what happens with regard to these foods that are sold outside of the school lunch program, but what about what is sold in the school lunch program? What about what happens when kids are out on the street? What about what happens at home? All of those things are important, but really, all of those things are important. That means we need to address all of them. Just fixing one isn't going to do that. In this report, which is, I hope, going to come out very soon, there are about 20 recommendations for steps that Oregon can take, and the contents of this bill are recommended by this study group. So I wanted to let you know that we had a homegrown panel that looked at some of these issues and fully endorsed the step that you're considering taking today. Thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions if time allows.
Thank you, Dr. Cohn. Any questions for Dr. Goldberg or Dr. Cohn? Representative Bruce?
Thank you. Can you tell me a little bit, we've talked about the numbers, but a little more specific on the numbers about the growth of type 2 diabetes among kids in Oregon?
Chair Kotek, Representative Bruin, thank you. You know, this is one of the things that I think has put the whole obesity epidemic on the map as a health problem. We're not talking about a cosmetic issue. We're really talking about health. Type 2 diabetes is a very serious disease. When I was in medical school, we used to call it adult onset diabetes because it was typically something that happened late in life to people who were very overweight. What's happened now is that more and more kids are getting diagnosed with this. We don't have very good data on the number of kids that are getting diagnosed, but I can tell you that anecdotally what I'm hearing from colleagues at places like OHSU, which is a big referral center, is that now the majority of the diabetics that they might see there are likely to be type 2 diabetics. That's very different from what would have happened 20 years ago. Diabetes is a very serious disease. There are health risks, including blindness, kidney failure, infection, heart disease, and so forth, particularly when it develops in children when they're so young. This is kind of a ticking time bomb sort of issue. So I think that really adds to the importance of this and the importance of addressing this now.
Thanks. All right. Those more questions. Thank you for coming. We really appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Look forward to the report, Dr. Kelly. We're going to come back to the second proponent panel, Nancy Becker and Paresh Patel. And then after that, we'll have David Williams and Janet Beer.
Hello. Ready?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Kotek, members of the Health Policy Subcommittee, and also Chair Buckley, and members of the House Education Committee for the opportunity to testify before you today in support of HB 2650. My name is Nancy Becker, and I'm a registered dietitian and the chair of the School Food Working Group of the Oregon Nutrition Policy Alliance. I teach nutrition in the chemistry department at Portland State University, and I'm the policy chair of the Oregon Dietetic Association. I'm also the proud parent of a varsity high school football and baseball player who loves to eat. So I'm going to tell you what HB 2650 will do. This bill sets nutrition standards for all foods that are sold outside of the National School Lunch Program. And as you know, the National School Lunch Program is regulated by the federal government, and certain nutrition guidelines must be met. However, other foods that are sold in schools, such as in the hallways, at school stores, and in the a la carte line, do not have to meet any guidelines. Examples of this are enormous packages of cookies and supersized pizza slices. I found a package of cookies when my son was in middle school that was 600 calories. It was 5 servings in one package. Anything goes in these foods with the goal of attracting customers. Oh, I guess not. Thank you. Since the goal of HB 2650 is to chip away at the causes of childhood obesity, this bill sets specific calorie levels for snacks and beverages that are based on science and are recognized reasonable levels of calories for snack foods. I can assure you that as a registered dietitian and nutrition professor, that these numbers are the best that nutrition science has to offer. The bill specifies standards for fat content, saturated fat, and sugar. And these closely mirror the standards set by the Snack Food Association's voluntary guidelines that have been established in conjunction with the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, which is known as the Clinton Agreements. In addition to being sensible and generally recognized as the standard, I would like to emphasize that the only way that a school food employee could compare the portion sizes of foods is to compare their calorie levels using numbers. How else could one compare the portion size of a Red Baron Solo pizza to a turkey pizza pocket, for instance? They don't look the same. They're not the same size. You can't guess which one is larger and which one is smaller. You have to use calories. So many schools have an a la carte line, which serves items in addition to the National School Lunch Program. This bill will set a calorie and fat limit on those a la carte foods. California's a la carte standard is 400 calories and 35% fat. After discussion with members of the School Food Service Association, a compromise was reached, and the calorie limit for a la carte in Oregon was raised from 400 to 450 because they thought it would be easier to have more foods fit. Now, how about beverages? Well, this bill very closely follows the voluntary guidelines already agreed to by the American Beverage Association. It'll remove sugary sodas and will set age-appropriate portion sizes for flavored milks and juices. Water is, of course, allowed at all grade levels. And here's some examples of, here's a chocolate milk that is currently sold in the National School Lunch Program. Here's a new product, another chocolate and strawberry milk product called Slammers that is been sold.
here's a pineapple orange juice that would sort of make the cut. Okay. In high schools, the bill would also allow diet beverages that contribute less than 10 calories per 8 ounces, and that would be things like Propel water, Diet Pop, and other flavored waters. I don't. And here's a flavored water. I don't have my somehow my Propel didn't make it into the.
Your son drank it.
I didn't touch the stuff myself. Are these standards the be all and the end all of healthier food? No. Okay. Many snack foods that we don't think of being healthy could fit. However, what this bill does is set appropriate portion sizes of snack foods for children and adolescents. I'm sure we all agree that a couple of cookies as a snack is not troublesome, nor is the occasional serving of French fries. Where kids get into trouble is when they have daily access in school to large plates of French fries or supersized juices and pop. Okay, so what about the local district wellness policies? Well, as you know, each of Oregon's 198 school districts was required to establish wellness policies this year. While the wellness policies were a step in the right direction, they did not get the job done. These wellness policies were supposed to address all foods sold on campus. As you've heard, only 20% of the policies submitted mention nutrition standards for food sold outside the National School Lunch Program, 20%. Now, how do I know this? Well, I led a team of health professionals, parents, teachers, and students, and many of them are here, in assessing these policies. And we examined them, looking for mention of standards, any standards, for these foods. Over 75% of the submitted policies were simply downloads of boilerplate policies from the web. Now, others, to be fair, were thoughtful guidelines, so there was a mixture. But here's the rub. How are vendors supposed to comply with 198 different versions of nutrition standards? That's how many school districts we have. How are they supposed to know what Medford standards are and then go 50 miles away to Ashland and figure out what their standards are? Besides, we know that students in Klamath Falls have the same nutrition needs and goals as students in Pendleton. This is not an issue of local control. It's the health of our students. Having consistent statewide nutrition standards for foods and beverages sold outside the National School Lunch Program supports our kids in making healthier choices and models appropriate healthy serving sizes. Others may speak of the issues of local control, but I'd like to emphasize that these standards set a minimal threshold for foods sold to kids in schools. If districts want to go further, they certainly can. And some have. And hopefully today you're going to hear from a couple of school districts that have gone farther than the basic minimum. So thank you for this opportunity to speak about this important issue. And I don't know if I should take questions now or have Mr. Patel.
Let's do Mr. Patel. Thank
sure.
you, Nancy. And then we'll
okay. Thank you. Chairs and committee members, my name is Dr. Parrish Patel. I'm president of Courtesy Vending, a company that operates vending machines in some Portland area schools. I'm also a member of the Portland Public Schools Wellness Advisory Committee. So as you can imagine, I wear two different hats that require me to do a balancing act, to say the least. Today, I'm not here to take a position on the legislation, but rather to briefly provide some information on the PPS standards that we developed last year and implemented in August 2006 for the current school year and how our company was able to adapt these requirements. The standards for all snacks on campuses were 35% or less of the calories from fat, 35% or less sugar by weight, 10% or less saturated fat, and 250 calories or less per package. To some, these standards may not seem overly restrictive, but to give you some perspective on the matter, of the 45 items that we typically filled in snack machines the previous year, only 5 of the items made the cut with these new nutrition guidelines. To fill the machines with approved items, we had to research and procure all new items. Virtually 40 of the 45 items had to be replaced. We were able to obtain the items and fill the machines. The challenge has been in actually selling the items, and I'll get to a little bit more on that a little later. Our company has been able to purchase and obtain the items that meet the PPS standards, and a subset of these items would meet the proposed standards because the proposed standards in this legislation is slightly more restrictive with the calorie counts. We recognize that childhood obesity is a growing concern, and we certainly applaud the support the movement to create uniform, comprehensive wellness standards for schools. But as you may be aware, obesity and nutrition are complex issues and real no easy solutions. We must also keep in mind what vending machines are and what vending machines are not. It seems lately that snack vending machines have become synonymous with junk food machines or junk food. However, vending machines are simply a distribution channel, a way to distribute goods to consumers. In that sense, a vending machine operator like myself is in most material respects indifferent as to whether a sale made is a candy bar or a granola bar. It's still a sale to the operator. Snacks can be a part of a healthy diet, and they do provide options for students when other sources of foods may not be available, such as during school, after-school practices and things of that sort. The challenge for our company really has been not in the procuring of items that meet the requirements. It's been in the area of having the products that students are willing to purchase. And that's a little bit more complex issue than actually just procuring the items, because purchasing the items is really going to take a behavioral change. And the impact of any changes to the policies or what's allowed in schools will be severely limited or diminished if it does not actually change a student's behavior. That means if they simply purchase the, let's say, less healthy items from convenience stores or from home and just bring it to school and continue eating them, the effect of the change has really been mitigated. If we are to succeed with the wellness movement and the changing the behavior of our kids, we need to educate the parents as well as have the parents buy into the policy. Over the course of the year, the kids spend way more days at home than they do at school, and we can't expect the schools to solely solve the problems that parents need to also take responsibility for. The solutions have to be long-term focused, especially because a change in behavior is required. We as parents, teachers, and the members of the community need to lead by example. So I close by leaving you with a thought. I challenge you to keep one point in mind. What restrictions and guidelines are you willing to live with yourself? It's not just about the kids, it's about you too. You can't expect the kids to stay away from the chocolates when you have a chocolate bar in your hand as you're talking to them. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today before you today. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Dr. Patel. Yeah. Representative Bruin, then Representative Gilson.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony, both of you. Dr. Patel, obviously, you're an expert when it comes to, I guess, the operation of vending machines and maybe some trends that go with that. And I guess my question to you would be, and maybe there's not a direct correlation, but as you've, I don't know how many years you've done this, but over the years you've done this, when you have changed product offerings, regardless of what the product offering is, I mean, maybe it's a Snickers bar for a Hershey bar, I don't know, but is there a time, is there an adaption time that is normal for any change of product, regardless of the nutritional, I guess, aims of the product?
This case is a little bit different because in normal scenarios, when we do change a product for another product, we actually see an increase in sales because you're changing product around, something's new in the machine, things of that sort. So if we were to take one chocolate bar out and put a different one in, we'll see an immediate spike in sales. In this case, we do see a decrease in sales. So it's kind of an inverse relationship in this case.
Okay. One more follow-up. Once again, in your experience in the vending machine world, if you will, how do the companies that produce the and maybe this is a question for the California experience, but do they, in your knowledge, do the people, do the consumer goods companies that manufacture these products, does their marketing effort follow policy? I mean, maybe I should ask a question to you. Did it follow policy in California? Did they change the way they marketed?
Mm-hmm.
once again, getting past your concern is, hey, it's one thing if you're just putting in the machine, but if somebody's actually marketing these products because they have a financial incentive to do so, does that help push them over the top?
Yeah.
Amanda, could you... I'm going to introduce myself again.
I'm Amanda Purcell, and I'm with the California Center for Public Health Advocacy. We saw exactly that. It's actually a really fascinating thing to watch the marketplace respond to this type of thing. Cliff Bars, actually, with the very first piece of legislation that we offered, and I think there's an example here. They put a little sticker on that says SB 19 compliant, which was our original piece of legislation. So it really presents a very interesting marketing opportunity companies, particularly those that are focused on the school environment, to really identify their products which meet the standards and then market those or identify those to schools when they're looking for products to put in their lines or in their machines. We've actually kind of seen this whole marketing process start in California, where both big and small companies are now realizing there's a niche, there's an unmet need actually that wasn't there before, and those that are quick to respond are going to find, obviously, a very willing marketplace.
Thank you.
Dr. Purcell, did you want to respond?
Just to kind of add on to that, I would agree that if there were more consistent standards, the manufacturers of products can tailor to that versus having, let's say, 198 different standards. It's hard to make product to fit that.
If I can just mention that... just recently, there's been an explosion of these new snack foods in small quantities. Just going to, you know, the local Fred Meyer, because I've been buying food to give out to all of you. You know, they're just 100-calorie packs of Chips Ahoy, baked Doritos, pretzels. These are really good. Peanut butter cookie crisps. And I've had to go back several times, and they're flying off the shelves. It's rather astonishing. People are buying these. I think this is an example of the culture and industry kind of moving along at the same time, because everybody realizes that those 600-calorie packs of cookies just, you know, they got to go. None of us can afford them.
Thank you. Representative Gelser?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question was along the same line, and I think I'll move it now more to a comment. It seems to me that if there were consistent standards, that the market, that desire for kids to buy a snack, to have something that they get to munch on between their classes, would eventually drive back up that sale at that point of purchase in the vending machine over time after they got over the withdrawal from the candy bar. And I'm wondering, as this wellness trend moves across the country, as you look at the options that are available to you in procurement, do you see additional options becoming available in terms of what you can procure to put in vending machines that might be more consistent with the standards outlined in this bill?
I think that initially it was more difficult because of I think the standards were more or less new, and as time goes on, more and more products are being introduced that meet the products, and a lot of times it just takes manufacturers to reformulate their recipe, so to speak, a little bit to, you know, maybe it's 36% fat and they need to get it down to 35, or it's 37 and they need to bring it to, I mean, they can reformulate a little bit, and we've seen some top name manufacturers work with their products and help them get to the requirements.
I'd also just like to mention that it's not just vending machines, but it's school stores and also foods on the a la carte line. You know, California's got a lot of people that drives a huge market. And, you know, it's our thought that we'll start seeing more and more products that will meet these guidelines because, you know, they're providing all these items for this large market in California. So it really does look like, you know, more is becoming available. I've also noticed just going around to schools and looking at their vending machines, they're empty in Portland Public Schools, which has made changes very similar. So the kids are buying the stuff because the vending machines are empty. They can't keep them stocked fast enough. They're, you know, they're buying the smaller sizes of milk and smaller bottles of juice and plain water. So it's going.
Representative,
in Portland Public Schools, just as a matter of cost, as the portion sizes have decreased, has the price gone down for for those smaller servings of juices or beverages?
Actually, it's kind of the opposite. The price usually goes up. It's just the way it works. most people don't realize it, but the cost of a product is more in the packaging and distribution and things of that sort than it is actually in the actual quantity of product. So if you've got a product that may be going through, you know, 10,000 cases or something, and you got another product that's just going through 100 cases, it actually costs more to get, you know, on a per unit basis to get those smaller quantities, even though the package size is small. One thing I did want to clarify about, I've heard several comments today about, you know, either the vending machines are empty or the machines are always out of water or the product flying off the store shelves and stuff like that. I think a lot of times, what people may not realize is there's other aspects that influence that, and one of them is, for example, servicing schedule. That you can't use that alone to think, you can't use that as evidence that it's actually selling or not selling, and we have first-hand information on what's selling and what's not. So a machine we might have been servicing once a day, maybe go to once a week or something like that. So you really need more data than just looking at what's empty and what's not.
Thanks for the clarification. Yeah. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question for Dr. Patel. The snacks that we've been talking about and that we've been looking at here are all packaged. What about an apple or an orange or a banana or something? I know that there are some vending machines that sell fresh produce other than in the Kaiser commercial that has an organic apple vending machine. But do you offer vending machines that have produce?
We currently do not offer any kind of vending machine that offers produce in schools. And really, that's something, and again, it's an issue of distribution, and for us to be able to offer, like, say, apples in a vending machine, we probably have to service it every day to put 3 or 4 apples or 5 apples in the machine, and it's just not cost-effective to do it. Some schools we work with, actually, we provide the machines to them, they rent it from us, and then they have their cafeteria staff actually stock it and refill it because they're there already. So there is an option such as that, but it's not really cost-effective or feasible for a vendor to actually do that, because to stop by every day to add a few apples or whatnot wouldn't make sense.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to move on to the next panel. And time check here, it's 4:30, and we wanted to get through four individuals that were categorized as the con side, the opponents who might have some issues with the bill. We want to give them a fair shake here at the dais. There are three people who said they cannot return on Thursday: Jana Wicks, Dr. Hillary Wells, and Dr. Dan Marks. Would it be possible for those three, if we go a little past, can we go past five, anybody?
Or
we?
We're kind of committed.
No, but you've got committee.
No, you don't have one person, so you can do it with this man.
Right, we can't. Well, let me think about that. So let's get started. Dave and Jenna Beer, please.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committees, my pleasure to be here. I want to, first of all, thank you all for having this very valuable discussion about the types of foods and offerings to students in schools, as well as an increasingly important social and public health problem of childhood obesity and its associated health costs going down the road. I am, as I walk up here, reminded of a movie I recently watched called Thank You for Smoking, but if you haven't seen that, I encourage you to go out and rent that film. The Oregon School Boards Association, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association, we are opposed to the bill, and that'll come as no surprise to a lot of people. And frankly, we are not here to dispute the fact that there's a problem with childhood obesity. We're not here even to dispute the fact that there are probably some schools out there that are not selling the healthiest foods. And I'm not here to defend those schools either. What I am here to defend is the fact that we in the state very closely cherish an institution, and that is our local school boards. We cherish the fact that these are 5- and 7-member boards who are locally elected and fiduciarily and locally responsible to their constituents, their voters and their taxpayers for the operations of those school districts. And it really comes down to a policy question about do we want to continue to support the fact that we have these local boards and the fact that we charge these boards with developing the operational principles and operational policies for their districts, or do you as members of this body want to now, as is increasingly apparent, become a 9-member school board? And I would suspect that you don't necessarily want to do that. The few folks in this body who have sat on boards or been involved with local policies understand some of the detail to which those board meetings revolve around is probably not something you all want to participate in. So I can sympathize with your dilemma and with your desire to want to do the right thing for schools and school children. But I would hope that maybe we might be able to find a way to still hold intact that local policy authority and that local decision-making authority while encouraging healthy choices in schools. The bill, as it was printed, 2650, frankly looks like a very excellent school board policy. It looks like something that districts should adopt around the state. In response to a question that some might ask, because there was a lot of discussion earlier about the California School Boards Association, which I know a lot of the people who work down there are very excellent, wonderful people. Last spring, the Oregon School Boards Association went out on the road, as we do every spring and every fall. And we had 17 meetings around the state and met with over half of all the school board members in the state. There are 1,400 school board members, so roughly 700 school board members in the state attended these meetings. And we asked them about our legislative priorities for the coming session. And we asked them about three items: ESD governance. It was a hot issue last time. School stability, funding stability, and school nutrition. And to an individual, we were told, continue to hold dear the principle of local control and continue to fight for the ability of local boards to decide what is the best decision for their community and their schools for the offerings in their districts. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Let's do Jennifer, and then we'll open it up for questions. Okay.
This is as a former board member and having the opportunity to open brand new district.
She was going to go away.
That's okay. He probably thought I was 20 of them. That's fine.
Yeah. I'll wait.
Thank you, Representative. Sorry to be so unclear there. Okay. Ms. Beer.
Thank you. Chair Kotek, Chair Buckley, members of the committee, my name is Janet Beer. I am a registered dietitian, the food service director for the Tiger Tualatin School District, and the president of the Oregon Child Nutrition Coalition, which is a food buying group representing 84 school districts in Oregon. I am opposed to the passage of House Bill 2650. I am in total agreement with the individuals who have submitted this bill in regards to the crisis we face concerning childhood obesity in this country. It is a drastic problem that urgently needs solutions. I am opposed, however, to the passage of this particular bill, which creates as many problems as it solves. In addition, this bill contains language that is confusing, it is unevenly applied to schools, and results in a misapplication of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. It is the obligation of staff in schools to teach students self-motivated, lifelong nutrition habits that are clearly demonstrated every day when students come for meals. Under this bill, the reasons products are offered or not offered are not clearly identified on the label if prepackaged and exist in a complicated nutrient analysis for all items that are not prepackaged. If the goal is to make an impact on reducing obesity and poor health, the students have to learn what to do when they are not in school. The Dietary Guidelines for Americans are aimed at the consumption of foods over a day or a week. They were never intended to be applied to each individual item as they have been in House Bill 2650. There are four different USDA menu planning options for breakfast and lunch meals in schools. These plans have different definitions for entrees and snacks. The bill has different standards for entrees and snacks. This would result in one school being allowed to sell a whole grain bagel and cheese sandwich item a la carte, and the neighboring school forbidden to do so. How does this make sense to students or anyone else? In addition, House Bill 2650 will have a financial impact on the food service departments in schools in Oregon. I have been a food service director for 15 years at Tiger Tualatin Schools, and I was an assistant director for 10 years at Portland Public Schools. In my experience, there is always a negative fiscal impact when drastic changes are implemented suddenly. Only 68 school meal sponsors in Oregon out of the 119 that had an audited school food service fund broke even financially in the 2003-2004 school year. That is the most recent year for which information is available. A bill implemented as drastically and abruptly as this can only decrease the number of school meal programs that can break even. A great number of the items that we sell a la carte are made in the school kitchens and are not prepackaged with nutrition labels. To meet the bill requires that schools must perform a nutrient analysis every time they stir two things together or place anything between two slices of bread. Less than 12 of the almost 200 school districts in Oregon are headed by registered dietitians trained to perform this analysis. The remaining districts will have to hire consultants to assist them to perform this function. This is a complicated bill. It is uncertain at best what a school board would have to do to be certain they are in compliance with these standards. In most schools, a great many number of organizations and programs sell food during the school day. It would be a major task indeed to evaluate and calculate each individual product's fitness as defined by this bill. The Oregon School Nutrition Association Administrators Chapter has voted to oppose House Bill 2650. An ad hoc committee was appointed to develop an alternate proposal. Attached to the written statement I have submitted is a draft of that proposal based on offering appropriate portion sizes, controlling the frequency of offerings, maximizing the variety of foods offered, and developed to be a program that is understandable and teachable. The Oregon School Nutrition Association has scheduled a session at the annual meeting on March 9, 2007, to give all members an opportunity to discuss and contribute to the further development of this proposal. I urge all of you to evaluate and seriously consider the Oregon School Nutrition Association Administrators Chapter alternate proposal. Please understand, I am not opposed to changing what we offer to increase the nutrient density of what students eat at school. Indeed, the only rice we sell in Tiger Tualatin schools is brown. All of the tortillas are whole wheat, and the sandwiches come on wheat berry bread. I am opposed to the cost and confusion that results when numeric standards are suddenly used to do this. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Beer. Representative Dolley?
If I understand the bill correctly, I'm going to move away from you, David, on local control. The bill then covers when we have offer versus serve, any item that is offered has to meet the criteria of the bill?
Any item that is sold individually, not part of a reimbursable meal, as defined by USDA.
Thank you.
Representative Gilson?
Thank you. I had a couple of questions. Should I...
Go right.
Great. One of the sentences in your testimony, Ms. Beer, just jumped out at me, and I wondered if you could help me understand it a little bit more. And it was that if too many changes occur at once, younger students have a tendency to bring snack lunches from home. And I'm wondering why that's a bad thing. I have four kids who like to buy hot lunch at school. They call it hot lunch because they get to go through the line and there's a snazzy machine they get to use and they get to load up at the salad bar. But we limit the number of times a week they're allowed to do that to one because we think we can provide healthier food for them and better control what it is that they're eating if we pack their lunch and we know what it is that we're putting into the bag. And if I understand the intent of the bill correctly, as I heard Representative Bruin explain it, that the
part of the point here is to give parents more control over what it is that their children are eating. So I'm wondering, first of all, what the danger is of children eating sack lunches that their parents pack for them at home, and secondly, what your position would be on my understanding of the intent of the bill, which is to give parents more control, talk about local control, the control of parents to control what their kids are eating. If you think that's a good thing for parents to have more control over what their kids eat.
In response to your first question, there are research studies that have been done to compare the average foods offered by school meal programs versus what comes in a sack lunch from home. And the nutrient density of the average school meal is much greater than the average sack lunch. And I have to say, from my observations from walking around in schools on a very regular basis at lunchtime, some parents do a really nice job of making offerings for their children. Some parents put in a Capri Sun, a Lunchable, Oreo cookies, and a lollipop, and that's lunch. So it's a mixed result of what parents actually send to students at school. Your second question as to whether or not giving parents more control over what their students consume at school, I would guess for most parents that's a good thing. I will tell you, I've had parents call me and say, just put something on your menu my child will eat. I don't want to make lunch. So there are some who would abandon that particular task.
Thank you. And I've got one more question for Mr. Williams on a different topic. I hear what you're saying about the local control issue. I'm not too formally a school board member, just still a couple of months ago, and I know sometimes we have these conversations and my school board hat starts to twitch. I know certainly conversations about we're providing most of the money, and I think, well, those are local school districts' money to make those choices. But when I was a school board member, we passed policies. We had site control in our district where individual school buildings would make choices about how to implement policies. And a lot of times when our board would go to make decisions for the good of the entire district, the individual schools would come to us and say, this is what we have principals for, and this is what we have parent-teacher associations for. As a legislator, I'm finding there's some things that make sense for the entire state. And when it comes to public health, or if we're looking at an epidemic of obesity or type 2 diabetes, it's hard for me to get my mind around how we could address those issues if we weren't doing it in a statewide way. And I know that I trust local school districts and local school boards to do a good job, and I know they want to do a good job, and many have really started to address these standards. But if they were, and if these standards were in place in that voluntary manner, why would the bill be a problem? Because wouldn't it just be putting into place in a more uniform kind of a way what the local school districts say that they want to do on their own anyway, and wouldn't we actually be helping them get out from underneath the difficulties of having to put together a complicated policy by making it easier to have more choices for everyone by having greater uniformity across the state?
Sure.
Can you speak to that a little bit?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser. A very good question, and frankly, it was the one that we posed to our membership in the spring. The question to them was literally, has the issue of childhood obesity become an overriding statewide concern such that the Oregon School Boards Association should step aside from the covenant of local control and allow this to happen? And all I can say is that overwhelmingly our membership said no, let us retain this authority. Now, my response back to them was immediately, well, then you better get your act in gear, otherwise you're going to get rolled on this. Okay, so I think that districts are aware of this, and I'm exceedingly frustrated that they aren't acting faster than they should. You are intimately aware of those processes that happen and the pushes and pull that local boards face. And I think that if everybody behind me in this room and all of those who have signed on with this bill, if we all got together in some kind of concerted effort to actually go out to districts and to boards who have not done this, that we would actually be able to make a more substantial change, because not only would we be able to implement something like this on the local level, but by doing it on the local level, the buy-in from a district and the support from the community for it would be that much stronger. You pass this now, it's viewed as just another state mandate that they'll begrudgingly have to find a way to comply and you know, probably look for ways to get around it if they can, or there'll just be really another reason for them to say, well, there's the legislature again taking away our abilities. I mean, that frankly is the responses that I get on the ground about the bill.
And I appreciate that response. I think I was really struck and stirred by something Representative Roblum said about schools ending up being the place that we have to solve so many social problems. And when I think about this and think about local school boards and all the things that they're dealing with, test scores, dropout rates, ESL, NCLB, all of these other things, I don't think obesity necessarily should be what they should be tackling at their school board meetings. I think that they should be tackling matters of curriculum and retention and meeting diverse student needs. And that's why in this case I almost think that we're taking something off the plate of local districts by creating a standardization and allowing them to focus on what it is that they do and know best, which is our kids' educational outcomes and educational programs.
Well said, Chairs and Representative Gelser, and I hope that if this bill passes, you'll come to our convention as a keynote and explain that to them.
I would be happy to do so.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn?
I, too, have a question for Mr. Williams. Earlier in our meeting here, shortly after 3, we had I have a hard time keeping track of time in this morning. School boards and school districts are given an opportunity to give their nutritional report. 24 school districts didn't give any report. 34 gave a boilerplate, a template back to this organization. What accountability or what responsibilities does your organization take in responding to requests? I know from last session, several legislators asked for a report that we still have districts almost 2 years later that have not responded to the report. I'm not big on, taking away local control at all, but how does your organization hold each other responsible?
My understanding of what was required came out of the reauthorization of the federal school lunch program, and it required all districts who participate in that program to adopt a wellness policy following specific guidelines around that adoption. The requirement did not require specific content of the policy. So first thing, of course, not every district in the state participates in the federal school lunch program. I think there are 3 that do not. Therefore, they would not have to comply with this. Okay. Now, following the adoption of that, those districts were then required to submit those policies, the adopted policies, to the Department of Education, the State Department of Education. And frankly, I can't speak to why a district didn't submit theirs. I think they ought to, and I have no idea why they wouldn't. We do track a lot of school board policies when it's commonly referred to boilerplate language. We have a policy department in our shop that helps develop various policies for districts, and probably some of that is language that came out of our shop. And if we open our doors to anybody who, if we have it in our shop, we'd be happy to provide it, but we're not the Department of Education. We're not the repository for all of them. We certainly don't have all districts participate in our program either.
Madam Chair, thank you. That's not the question. What internal balances and methods do you have within your organization to help monitor your own group of people or help them,
Sure.
Yeah.
Well,
what checks and balances do you have?
We are a membership organization that responds to the demands and desires of our membership, and our membership are local school boards. If they have rules they are required to comply with, we make them aware of that and tell them they ought to comply with them. When they are required to submit a policy to the Department of Ed, frankly, they're required. We don't have any capacity to go out and act as an enforcement body for the Department of Ed. It's frankly not our role. If I had a list of those 24 or how many that didn't submit it, I'd be happy to do due diligence and see if we can't track them all down for you.
Thank you.
Representative
Dell. Yes, Dave, I want to pursue what Representative Comp is talking about, because I understand the relationship between you and your members, but if you could, and I don't want to talk about the school lunch, I want to talk about vending machines and policy, because I'm somewhat familiar with how your policy works. and how you support school boards in adopting that policy. So before I get in there and muck around as a legislature in the local control issue, your agency has to provide me with some notion of how many people do I have to do this for. I mean, if you won't bring me the figures, then I must assume that I have to get in there for everybody. Interfering with local control is a huge issue with me. But I want to know, 198 school districts, are 100 of them in compliance in essence with this law? Then we have one conversation. If it's two of them, we have another conversation. So I would like some notion, if you could bring to us at one time before we do the work session on this bill, how many are in compliance with a policy similar to this?
Yeah, should we be happy to get our policy department on that? Again, we house a lot of policies from districts around the state. We do not have all of them. I don't know, you know, what kind of turnaround we can get for districts responding. If they're not responding to the Department of Ed, my guess is they're not going to respond to us, and we don't have the stick like the Department of Ed does. We're not a state agency. We're just a lowly association built on our membership.
Nice try. Mr. Williams, I have a question for you. I understand the perspective of local control. However, we're in the Health Policy Committee. It's a public health issue. The state sets standards around immunization. They set standards around child safety in terms of bullying standards. You know, we don't want our kids to be unsafe in the schools. How is this different?
Let's see. The two specifically mentioned immunization requirements, those are a requirement for other agencies to certify that kids receive those immunizations before they come to school. Schools are not required to actually immunize kids.
Required. There are requirements that types of immunizations students have to have in school that every school has to comply with.
Correct. And if students do not have those immunizations, they receive notification not from the school but from the Department of Health. The other issues, I think it's no secret that our association has been in this building for a number of years, continuing to guard the local control mantra, if you will. This morning, testifying on a bill that would mandate specific minutes of physical education. Any number of areas where our members feel that it is the purview of a locally elected board, we are going to be there to raise that note of concern with you all as you attempt to make state policy.
Thank you for that response. There are a lot of different experts on school boards, variety of backgrounds. How many public health or medical folks do you have on your school boards? To ask your school boards if they think child obesity is an issue that you need to deal with, their expertise to be able to answer that question?
Madam Chair, I do not know how many public health experts sit on school boards. School board members are people who seek office for any variety of reasons, just as you all seek office to the legislature. They are elected people who put their name on a ballot and sought election to a board. I cannot answer that question. I'd be happy to look into that.
That would be helpful. I would be curious.
Sure.
You know, I think the challenge for me is local control around what is taught based on the values of a community. The health of a child is not based on where they live. And so it's hard for me to put that under what would go under local control type of decision making. So, you know, I think from my background, that's not a surprising statement, I'm sure. I have a question for Ms. Beer. I have a clarification. So the full Food Service Directors Association of Oregon has not taken a position.
No, that meeting is in March.
Okay. And could you describe for me the administrators chapter?
The Food Service Directors that belong to the association have a chapter that's just directors and managers only.
And how many people are on that group?
You know, I can't say.
So they're making a recommendation to the full association?
Yes. They've asked for a session where the proposal, which is just at this point a draft, can be discussed and fleshed out and considered, and a more definite thing hopefully will come out from the association supported by the board of the association.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. I have another question around how we determine what is healthy and nutritious food. What we're trying to do in this bill is quantify it, as I believe it was Nancy Becker, or, you know, you can't look at something, eyeing it, and know how they compare. The easiest way to do that is calories, actually getting some numbers. And you seem to disagree with that. Could you?
I do. Yes and no. And I've been a dietitian for 33 years, and I have to admit this bill is very confusing and very hard for me to look at the products I offer to sell to students and figure out what's in and what's out. And it's on the lunch. It's not on the lunch. It's on my lunch. It's not on Carol's lunch.
Can I clarify? But we're not talking about the lunches.
No, but the things I sell a la carte come generally from my lunches. So if I'm selling sandwiches on the menu today, that's what I put out for a la carte. You can buy the sandwich by itself. You can buy the burger by itself. You can buy the bean burrito by itself.
Okay. So, and I apologize for cutting you off, but
no problem.
If you told your vendors that these were now the requirements, and we could only purchase based on these requirements, they would then give you a list of things that you could choose from, so that it really wouldn't, you wouldn't have to try to figure it out. You'd only pick from the list. Would that be true?
Well, if I wanted to only sell packaged products, yes, but I don't. We create many products in our own kitchens, and I will have to perform nutrient analysis every time I take two things and put them together. And we make our own burritos, we make our own hamburgers, we make salads, we make all kinds of things where we take individual components and put them together for a meal, or just for a la carte, perhaps. And some of those items under this bill don't meet the definitions because they are very tight. And there are four different menu plans. So Newberg can sell it, but I can't because I use a different menu plan.
I don't understand the menu plan.
Their USDA says you can design school meals based four ways. You can do what's called traditional, 2 ounces of meat, a bread, a fruit, a vegetable, a milk. You can do what's called assist new menus, where you do a nutrient analysis and you have an entree and one other thing, and then you have all these numbers you have to match. You can do.
I guess I think my confusion is why I'm being confused is that we've been told that this is not related to the USDA.
But it's standards. I guess I'm here to say it does. It won't change what I offer on a reimbursable meal, but it changes what I can take off of that meal and sell to students. And because we have different menu plans, we have different things on our meals. And so in some buildings, in my school, a bagel with 1 ounce of cheese is an entree. And in the school next door, it's not. It's a snack because we use different menu plans.
Okay. Let me dwell on that. I see some other. I'm going to step back from
It's horribly confusing.
I appreciate that. Representative Roland.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to do a clarification for you as a high school principal. My food service people cook a meal, and they design that meal based on the standards that the federal government does, and they put that meal out for a person that's getting a free or spice lunch or anybody that wants to buy the whole meal. That's one way to get a meal at school. But my same people, my same cooks, have cooked, made extra of that main course. They have made extra, maybe French fries were in it, French fries. They have made extra other salad, all those other things. Each one of those as a component part can be set over here in the a la carte and be sold individually. Now, they aren't packaged. They come from the same ingredients that we had before, but they now have become a la carte, which is covered in this meal.
Right.
Because the people who are not getting free and reduced price lunches can buy a la carte.
And thank you for the clarification. However, I guess my question would be is if you're following some guidelines based on USDA, there are numbers involved in that as well. Is that correct? In terms of calories?
It depends on which plan you take.
That's correct.
If I might help you, they're not the same numbers as we have in the bill.
No.
And I think that's where the confusion is. In fact, if you want kids to eat, you offer them several different ways to get to the food. And so I'm going to say that maybe 35-40% will take the full meal deal, and the rest will buy a bottle of water out of the vending machine, pick up a sandwich, and maybe something else off your a la carte. So you have as many variations eating that are matching and mixing. So you have all kinds of numbers to deal with.
That's correct.
And I think that's... We don't know, for example, in the morning, the cook would make cinnamon rolls. And if we had 900 kids, they'd all be there. But the cinnamon roll then would have to be, because it's not part of breakfast, it's something that it would have to be cut in half. An analysis would have to be done to determine how many calories are in the cinnamon roll. So there are some problems with at least the way we serve meals now. The cinnamon rolls meet all the guidelines for USDA meals. But I don't think they would meet these guidelines.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I just say I'm very glad that Representative Roebland did not bring his Linder balls.
Well, I'm hoping that maybe we can. I know there are other food service people who might also be able to enlighten us. And so if we could, brief comment, then I think we'll move on, because I apologize for muddying the waters here. But
you're really hungry.
I was just going to say that because Oregon does not give any extra money to their program, most of the food service programs that make money and actually can afford it so they don't run in debt in this program, it is because of the stuff we sell on the a la carte that makes that money. And I'm just telling you that because of that issue, that creates some other kinds of problems. And that's why I brought up at the very beginning of this meeting, I brought up the federal standards for lunches, because it drives a whole lot of things at our school, and they are not in line with this bill. And I have to go to my other meeting just down the hall for...
I think one of the things that I would want to ask, and I want to look to the expert and ask you, when we get government commodities or reduced price, are they generally very high carbohydrate content?
Well, commodity dollars are primarily spent on protein products. Most of the money we get is meat, cheese, those kinds of things. Schools have a lot of choices in what they spend that money on. So, no, I would not say they're high carbohydrate.
Thank you.
Yeah. Chair Kotek, part of your question when you started was, if we have these standards, won't vendors bring you products that meet these standards in packages? And the answer is maybe yes, maybe no. Oregon is very small on the national scale as far as a consumer is. If we were Texas or New York or California, then yes, vendors start to pay attention. However, even when you are large, I was at a meeting recently, and one of the vice presidents of ConAgra, one of the largest food manufacturing companies in the world, was saying there are 24 states that have all these different bills, and they get bids for products that don't exist. And they have to stop and say, are we going to stop the line and fix this line to make it perfect for this buyer? Oregon is not one of those kinds of buyers. At the same meeting, I sat with a woman who is the national sales manager for J&J Snacks, and they sell a variety of packaged products. They're all labeled so we could figure them out. They recently lost a major bid because their product was 1/10 of 1 ounce too heavy. So they were disqualified. So when you use numbers to make these decisions, you wind up with what I call nutrition nonsense. And you wind up with products that you think ought to be in or out, and products that are out maybe ought to be in, and it just makes a mess. And then you overlay that with the confusion that exists in USDA's 4 different menu plans for school meal programs, and you add one more thing, which is USDA is in the process of developing new guidance for school meal programs based on the dietary guidelines. That will come out in December or January. And it will come out as a proposed rule. That will have a bunch of these math numbers in it, possibly 770 milligrams of sodium, 14 grams of whole grains, and you have all these layers, and it's just impossible to figure out what the dickens you can sell, and impossible to teach a student what to do when they leave your counter, because I can't explain to you how we do it. I can explain to myself some days.
And thank you for the feedback. In some ways, you're making an argument why we need national standards, because then we'd all be...
There was lots of discussion at this national meeting about national standards.
Well, what I would argue is
until
that,
we get there.
The flip side of this is that with California, we can create a greater market availability. It's very difficult for a rural school to implement this because they don't have the capacity to go after some of these things. They don't have the scale. If we as a state go buying and selling the same product, we can tag on to California. So, I mean, then the flip side is we have to create a bigger market if we're actually going to implement this.
And that's for packaged products. You're still stuck with all the stuff we make in our kitchen.
Well, I'm hoping we'll get some other feedback about that, because I know there's some other... But thank you for your testimony.
You're
really appreciate it.
Thank you
very much. Time check. It's 5 after 5. Several members have to leave. We are going to stay... Okay. We can only have this room until 5:30. So for the second panel that we were going to have with the Soft Drink Association and the Vending Association, is it possible for you to come back on Thursday?
No.
Are you Mr. Liberti? Or?
Yes.
Okay. Then please come on up. And then Ken, is it Pastega?
The big man.
Thank you for your patience. We will be going over till Thursday, but I have requested. So here's our options. We have several individuals who say they cannot come back on Thursday. Dr. Dan Marks, Laura Thielander, Dr. Wells, and Jana Wicks. And I know there was a request to have Christy Obink come with. I would like to get the person from Seattle for sure. We have an individual down from Seattle today. So you're next. Gentlemen, you're
I'm
on.
I'm Lou Liberty, Venlo Services, Coos Bay, Oregon. I've been in the vending business since 1964. These aren't comfortable meetings for me, so if I hesitate or... I presently serve seven small districts on the South Coast. I was involved in three wellness policies, served on two of the boards, and then helped another school with some policies. So, and I passed out a sticker card for each one of you just to show you that this... And I want to talk about consumption at my two biggest schools, Marshfield and North Bend. And first of all, I'll chat about junior highs and elementary schools. I'm only involved in two junior highs, and those machines are in the gym, and they're timed out and come on after school and on the weekends when the gyms are leased out for activities of adults and other things. So junior highs, in my estimation, are totally out of context, and this bill is not conducive to high school students who have, every one of my seven schools have open campuses. So they're, and most of them have 7-Elevens or some kind of convenience store very close to them.
Is this from you?
Yes.
I just note this is a candy bar with 280 calories.
And it's under $10.
You're trying to keep us away.
Well, for dinner. There you go.
That's a peanuts.
But my two largest schools, my consumption on all of my products, from my snacks to my granola bars to my Snickers, Hershey bars, and all, are about three-quarters of that bar per week per student. That gives you a great idea of how little my students in high school are consumed. I don't deal with junior highs, and I don't deal with elementary twos. So I shouldn't, this bill does no good for that, other than what Mr. Roblin said and about the lunch programs and how they are served.
And I'm sorry, I'm not, could you rephrase that point? So it's no good for...
What I'm saying, what... This bill, I only want to talk about high schools because the vending industry is not involved in the elementary school at all.
Okay.
Or
thank you, sorry.
The junior high. Okay. So typically we're 9th through 12th graders, which I feel deserve a choice and have a choice because at least the seven schools that I serve all have open campuses. And our wellness policies are working. My sales in my seven schools are down about 15% to 18%, okay? And that's because of the choices that the school board and the committees have made in changing products and doing things. And Dr. Patel said the same thing. You know, his sales are down in the Portland School District, okay? In 10 years, maybe they'll come back if all we have is healthy snacks. I can't answer that question, but I'm telling you, from last year, the wellness policies were in effect since September. I'm down 15% to 18%. Okay?
And I'm sorry. So that's a success because you're...
Because of the change of products that we've made. Some of these smaller products I've tried to put in. They don't sell. I pull them out. You know, and I'm restricted on three of my schools went straight to diets in some of my drinks, okay? And I'm only referring, because most of my schools I share with Coke or Pepsi on the drink side, so I don't, I'm just talking about the candy, essentially, and snack items, because I can truly talk about it one-on-one because there's no other snack vendor or competitor in my market, okay?
Okay.
So when I talk about the drink side, I would give you distorted sales figures if I talked about drink business, because I don't know what Coke or don't know what Pepsi does alongside of my machine. Okay, and I in 5 of my 7 high schools, I use refrigerated machines that I sell apples and I sell other products. So along with that, 3/4 of a unit per bill is per week per student is inclusive of all of my products that I sell. Okay. And again, our wellness policies that we have on the coast and have implemented have worked. You guys, I think this is premature in what's happening. You know, you hear about what's being reported, but I think when you get parents and school members and PTAs involved and hospitals and doctors all on the two boards that I, or two policy deals I served, had all those members on, they do make effective changes, okay, and have.
Thank you, Ms. Liberty. Questions? Is it Ms.
Pastega.
Thank you for
My name is Ken Pastega, and I'm representing the Oregon Soft Drink Association. And I want to thank Chairman Kotek and Chairman Buckley for allowing me to come here today and the committee here. Our family has been in the soft drink business for close to 60 years, 1948. Pepsi is our most recognizable brand. And just to give you a little data, the market share of the major colas has been dropping consistently year after year. Not that we're losing sales, but people are finding alternatives to soft drinks. We used to have 10 to 20 different brands of soft drinks. Now we have over 200 in our facilities. I'll review with you some of the information I put in the folders I handed out to you. But we are a responsible corporate citizen with a passion for our communities we service. We have, I gave you a map of the state of Oregon with all the different Pepsi and Coke bottlers and a list of names that represent those facilities are represented for it. Also, a list of different brands that we sell that are non-sugar, except for juices, which have sugar in them, from both Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, a number of diets, sugar-free teas, also water, which on this list there's close to 20 different waters that we sell. So the other thing is we use a private tracking company like Nielsen that measures television audiences, a number of different measurements they do on consumer habits. In our convenience store business, where there's a lot of freedom of choice, over 50% of the beverages that are now consumed in convenience stores are still drinks, which are non-carbonated drinks. And you can see the consumer trend is shifting to those other beverages, and there's no legislation in a convenience store. That's freedom of choice. And the consumer can go in there and pick out whatever they prefer. So automatically, these changes in preferences from sugared soft drinks are going to diet soft drinks, are going to teas, going to all kinds of different products that we sell. Water is growing probably more than any product that we sell. And we sell Aquafina, Coca-Cola sells Dasani, and they have flavors, and we came out with a product called Alive, but anyway. We have developed responsible guideline for our industry, which we have been implementing, and inside there you'll see a brochure from the American Beverage Association that basically outlines we don't sell any soft drinks in elementary schools, first of all. And in middle schools, we'll sell juice and water. And then it also outlines the high schools, which right now, the high schools that we service in our county areas do not have any sugared soft drinks that aren't on machines that turn on after school and the children have left the the schools at that point in time. So we feel we're responsible corporate citizens that we don't need legislation to tell us, first of all, where consumers are going, what school districts prefer for the students that they're looking out for daily and what they're consuming. And as you read through the information here, basically we've made an alliance with the American Heart Association and the Bill Clinton Foundation basically to give us guidelines that the beverages that we sell in schools are healthy for the students. And so...
Mr. Pistay, can I interrupt a second?
Sure.
Because my understanding is the bill does, it essentially includes those voluntary guidelines coming out of that national agreement. So it sounds like you wouldn't have difficulty following those.
Well, I feel that, you know, the school district should make those choices. We don't need to layer laws. You have a federal law, and now you're going to layer it with a state law. It seems like it's almost too much, and at what point in time do school district representatives, school board members, make any decisions? And so, no, we're not in favor of this bill. We're just concerned that we would like local school boards to make their own decisions. And we're in compliance in the majority of our schools right now. Some of the schools that are contracts are expiring, they will comply with the guidelines that our industry has developed for them as soon as these contracts have ended. So I think that, and the other thing concerns us, if we come out with new products, last year in our own facility, we came out with 30 new brands and products for consumers. Now, these new guidelines, do we have to go through some kind of a approval process to get them compliant with the Oregon law? We'll make sure they're compliant without an Oregon law. We don't need any structure to give us direction on what products we can sell to the consumers. We're, like I said, we understand where people want to go with obesity. I mean, if you look at it from my standpoint, we need more exercise in our, you know, in the way parents and schools deal with kids. But I know that's an expensive process. But
I just could maybe wrap it up in a minute because I have to get six people in before 5:30.
Okay.
And I want to make sure we're
I'm basically done.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
If you have any questions, I'd be.
And
we
have your contact information, so if there are follow ups for both of you. Any questions for this gentleman? I apologize for rushing you.
That's okay.
More people interested than we might have thought. It always takes longer than you think.
That's
so
good.
Thank you very much for being
thank
here.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
So Representative Esquivel, one of our co-sponsors on the bill, and then could we have Laura Thielander and Hillary Wells also come up with the representative?
I'm going to move them fast and let Chrissy Obig go.
And you are?
I'm Dr. Wells.
Oh, hi, Dr. Wells. Okay. Christy, would you like to come up? I appreciate that, Dr. Wells. If you have written testimony and you can't be here on Thursday, please make sure we get it. Thank you.
Representative Esquivel, District 6, Bedford. Very briefly, I want you to know that our soft drink distributors in Southern Oregon think this is a great bill. And the reason being is because in Jackson County, we have implemented this over 2 years ago. Right now, it has been very successful in the lower grades as well as the mid-schools. There is a compliance, I guess one would say, compliance of the individuals in the high school, but that's going to take time to change that because we have open campuses, and, of course, they all go to the local convenience store and purchase whatever they want, which is fine. But I do want you to know that this is successful in Jackson County. It has been for a couple of years, and the distributor that I talked to thinks that this is a very good bill. So just wanted to let you know.
Thank you. Thank you for being here, Representative. Mrs. Thielander?
Yes.
Welcome.
Chair Kotek, Chair Buckley, committee members. My name is Laura Thielander. I represent the American Diabetes Association and the over 1 million Oregonians affected by diabetes and prediabetes. We've heard a lot of things. I'd like to talk to you about the cost of diabetes to the state of Oregon. In 2002, the cost of diabetes was $1.7 billion. That doesn't include costs of employees missing work time and the effect on the economy, and this is just adults that we're talking about here. In the year 2000, of those children born, 1 in 3 will develop type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. We know this. And if you're from communities of color, it'll be 1 in 2. We need to do everything that we can to prevent diabetes in our youth and our workforce in Oregon. If we don't do those things, it could severely affect Oregon's economy. The other thing I'd like to talk about is many people talk about local control. The American Diabetes Association is a volunteer-run organization that has volunteers on committees for events and programs up to the national level. We couldn't do what we do without volunteers. The ADA set guidelines for our staff meetings, volunteer meetings, programs, and events so that even our galas have to meet a certain food guidelines, which are very similar to these, in order to have them at hotels, conference centers. And we've never had a problem with anybody meeting those food guidelines or even charging us exorbitantly high prices to do those things. We found it very able to do, and we model this on every level of the organization within and without. So I think these things can be done.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Questions? Thank you very much for coming down. Christy.
Chair Kotek. Chair Buckley. Committee members, thank you.
Excuse me 1 second, Christy. Yes. And then Dr. Marks, do you still want to testify? Great. And then Ms. Wicks? Great. You're on deck. Christy, you're okay.
My name is Christy Obink. I'm a registered dietitian. I've worked for Portland Public Schools Child Nutrition Program for 28 years. My job is to provide students with well-balanced meals that they will eat and they'll enjoy at a reasonable cost to students and to taxpayers. I believe, I am in support of this bill. Number one, I do not believe it is difficult to implement. Janet is absolutely right. Sometimes what we do does not make sense to students. We are used to dealing with that. We do have requirements for the child nutrition program. It says that we need to offer a minimum number of calories. It's about 660 calories. Most of our entrees are well under the 400 calorie level. And we are used to having different calorie levels for different age groups, whether it's K-8, whether it's K-5, or whether it's 9-12. We're used to doing that. So that is not difficult. It's similar to what other states are doing. So from my point of view, I can go to a manufacturer, or they're already coming to us saying, we've got this packaged item, or we have this item, and it does meet the guidelines. So that is nice. It's also an advantage to have a list of items that I can list, and I can give to my student stores, I can give to my vending machine contractors, and say, here are some foods that you can sell. I can give them to PTAs. Here's what you can do for fundraisers. They appreciate that because they can't understand the guidelines. That's what I'm there for, and that is why you still need a nutritionist in your in your facility. But most of all, what I want to mention is, for me, this levels the playing field. Unfortunately, child nutrition programs have been under the gun to break even. To try to keep the dollars in the classrooms, which is where it should be, we as food service directors are forced to try to stay in the black. And one of the ways we do it is to sell a la carte, entree items, parts of the meal, and we sell our regular lunch. And we started doing that, and I remember 28 years ago, in response to the fact vending machines and student stores opened up in our campus and they were selling candy. And all we had was the lunch program. And oh my gosh, we saw these kids take their lunch money and go buy a candy bar, or take this lunch money and go buy a soda. So we said, what can we do? Kids don't want just the lunch. They want hands. We did it. And so we started competing with them. And in a sense, we started competing with ourselves. And so what this does, but there's a catch. In the cafeteria, we can't serve Coke. We can't serve that Snickers bar. There are some things we can't serve, but can still be sold in the vending machines and in the student stores and as fundraisers. So we are still at the disadvantage. So for me, as a food service director, I see this as leveling the playing field. Now, anybody coming in, the PTA that wants to sell the Krispy Kremes in my middle schools at breakfast, I now have a policy, because Portland did pass a policy. It's much more rigorous than this, and I'm not proposing that anybody do that. It's just Portland's policy. But I have a policy now that I can say this is not allowed. And I will tell you, when I presented this policy to middle school principals and high school principals, I got an applaud. Because this is something that they deal with in their schools all the time. They have PTAs that want to sell popsicles during lunch. And these are well-intended PTA people. And they don't want to say no to them. I can have a policy that is good for kids. Principals like it. Teachers like it. I would just like to finish by saying, and I have to read the statement because it's really important to me, is that I understand this bill alone will not solve childhood obesity. But in combination with other positive efforts towards increasing physical activity, invigorating health education, and finding more resources to add Oregon's rich array of agricultural products to the school meals served over the state, we can begin to improve the health of Oregon's children. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Christy. Questions?
Just a comment. Just thank you for a very clear statement.
Representative Wisnett, then Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your testimony, and I will not be pushing to get rid of your position.
Wise man.
You look like you're very enthusiastic about your job. So I'm like,
thank you.
You're the biggest school system in our state.
Yes.
And we just heard testimony by another nutritionist that she didn't want this bill, and mm-hmm. you're saying you're doing it. Mm-hmm. And it's also hard for me to get rid of my ways and means experience from last session. I know from testimony last year that a lot of the schools do not make money. Does Portland schools make money with your... Are you subsidized by the...
We are not. We are not subsidized. And this year, we are looking to break even.
Good.
Thank you for asking that.
And is it because you have more folks eating the... Pre-reduced.
Well, that we made a lot of changes last year. Last year, we did lose an incredible piece of my operating budget. But this year, we are on schedule. We've made a lot of changes. We've really beefed up in Portland. Just so you know, we're not comparing apples to apples here. We eliminated all the a la carte in our lunch program, and because we just found that that was simpler. As dietitians and as nutritionists, we felt we needed to offer kids, and we needed to have them see what a balanced meal really looks like, whether they choose to eat it or not. If they get a piece of pizza on the lunch line, they get a trip through the salad bar, which has fresh fruits and vegetables and has low-fat milk. That's just the way it goes with every entree offered. So, and I'm not proposing that. That is just something we've chosen to do. But by eliminating all that a la carte, we did gain more kids in the lunch line. This year, by eliminating the worst offenders in the vending machines and closing down some of the operations in the student stores, which, don't get me wrong, those funds go to very valuable programs. Schools are underfunded, period, the end, we know that. But the fact of the matter is I had a 10% increase in my high schools this year for lunches. I had 10% more kids eating in my open campuses, eating and taking a complete meal. The money that I received from that reimbursement offsets the loss from the revenue from the vending machines for me.
Thank you for the clarification that Portland is going way beyond.
We are. We're way beyond, and that is not. That is a local choice.
Thank you, Chrissy. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms.
Abig. Close enough.
My apologies.
That's fine.
Now, Ms. Beers talked about the meals that they construct, you know, from scratch with component parts.
Correct.
And your comments, I interpreted them to be more of addressing the packaged element.
Okay.
And so, but you said it leveled the playing field.
Well,
but
let
if you're
me
talking,
two different things.
To clarify.
Good. Thank you. Two different things. Janet is absolutely right in that most cafeterias will offer parts of the meal that they've made from scratch. as an a la carte item. So in other words, if the student doesn't want the complete meal with the salad bar, we used to just sell the piece of pizza. If that piece of pizza fit in terms of calories and fit the standards for my school lunch program, 98% of the time it's going to fit in these standards for calories, fat, and carbohydrate. Because we already have standards for the lunch program. So, for instance, the calorie standard for the lunch program is about 660 calories, one-third of a student's RDAs in calories. I have to serve a milk. That's about 100 to 130 calories. I have to serve fruits. I have to serve vegetables. That's another 100 or so calories. By the time you deduct all of that, my entree is already at about 400 calories and generally lower in fat. So that's why I think absolutely any bill, any time you try to fit numbers to real food, it really is a science trying to match an art of eating. And you're going to have some foods drop out. You're going to have some things that are kind of screwy-looey. But for the most part, and looking at my entrees, most of my entrees would fit these criteria if I was to sell them a la carte.
Thank you. Thank you, Christy.
Yes.
Appreciate your testimony.
Yes. Thank you for your time.
Is there a Kevin Grove in the room? Student?
Yeah.
Can you come back on Thursday?
What time is it at?
We'll be back at 3 on Thursday. Okay. I just want to make sure. I noticed we have a student, so you can come back. That's great. Appreciate that. Dr. Marks and Ms. Wicks, you're going to be our final two. So while they're coming up, what we're going to do, we will have additional testimony on Thursday at 3 o'clock. What I'm going to ask is I'd like the proponents to come back with some rebuttal to some of the things you heard. We also have a variety of opponents and proponents who still want to testify. We're going to hear you all, and if you cannot come back and I somehow missed your name, if you can submit written testimony, we'll make note of that. And just for the record, we have written testimony from the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Primary Care Association that we'll submit into the record. Dr. Marks.
Thank you, chairs and members. I'll keep this down to 2 minutes. I know it's late. My primary job, I think, here is to not repeat numbers and statistics. I'm on the front lines of that. I'm a member of the Center for the Study of Weight Regulation as a research scientist, and I'm a pediatric endocrinologist at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. So I take care of the children who are suffering from this problem. It's been my area of expertise has been childhood obesity since, well, for the last decade at least. And so the main thing I want to convey to you is that while this is certainly a problem that deals with fiscal issues, et cetera, these children that I see in my clinic who are affected by this problem really are suffering and really are, in fact, dying from this problem. And, in fact, there's a paper that was published recently which demonstrated that the quality of life of a child who is affected by obesity is equivalent to that of a child who is undergoing chemotherapy. So this is not a trivial issue. This is really something that is a public health issue and, in my mind, really supersedes sort of smaller arguments about, you know, how are we going to implement this from a fiscal point of view. This is really an urgent problem and is really something that is affecting child health right now as we speak. The other thing I would like to point out is that, to remind us all, is that this is not an issue of cosmetics. We're not trying to make children thin. In fact, we don't ever discuss weight in my clinic. It never comes up. The issue is about, and the American Academy of Pediatrics stated it, it's about habits and not habitus. What are we teaching children to do on a day-to-day basis? What are our schools tacitly putting their stamp of approval on in order to allow kids to take that education home and teach it to their parents? And I think it's really important that we begin to equate this to the tobacco issue of the 1950s. Everybody smoked. Even physicians smoked in those days and, in fact, advertised for smoking companies in those days. And it was a very huge public health issue, and it took a bunch of chinks in that armor collected over a long period of time to finally bring down big tobacco and begin to get rid of this problem. And this is exactly what we're dealing with here. This bill doesn't accomplish everything. But like a lot of these things, you've got to chip away at this over a long period of time in order to, again, preserve the health of our children, which for the first time ever, they aren't expected to have the same life expectancy that we all do. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Marks. And thank you for the reading material. Questions? Ms. Wicks, you get to wrap us up for the day.
Okay. I'll go under 2 minutes. Okay. I'm Jana Wicks, and I'm the president of the Oregon School Nutrition Association. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on Health Bill 2020. 2650. I represent over 600 members who feed two meals a day to the 559,244 children of our state every day. That's 40 million lunches a year and 20 million lunches, breakfasts a year.
Wow.
After a thorough survey from our executive board, it is a consensus that everyone agrees that Oregon needs healthier choices in our schools. We do, however, have some concerns about the constraints of finding new products that meet the guidelines. Schools do not have the resources to calculate the nutritional standards on some products. We have 116 districts in our state that are under 500 students, and they do not have the luxury of having a registered dietitian on staff to do the calculations for them. For instance, the Nutri-Grain bar, it contains all the right things: oats, nuts, dried fruits. Sounds like a good nutrient-dense food, but according to the proposed rule, it is either too high in sugar or sodium, and in a lot of our districts who have gone to a nut-free zone, it really limits the choices. We feel this needs to be implemented slowly to give the districts and the market time to adapt. Please remember that this is the first year of the wellness policy in our state, and it is only going to get better if we go slowly and remember to make these changes thoroughly understood by all. We are concerned that this is an unfunded mandate and not in the best interest of school food service programs as it is written. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Whitson. Do you work at a particular school?
I do. I'm a frontline worker at McCormick Elementary in Eugene.
In Eugene.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Okay. Questions? Any questions?
Just a quick response to the previous testimony about the calorie level of entrees, et cetera. Once you go down the guidelines, you're already completely underneath the limits in this bill.
Some districts probably are.
Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you both. And okay. I think you can see from the final two testimonies we have some very significant issues to address, public health issue as well as how do we implement this at the local level. So we'll be back on Thursday for additional testimony on this bill. Appreciate all your patience today. Those of you who are in the overflow room, thank you for watching. And
The education full committee will come back. Vice Chair Dahlin will chair all of you.
Oh, on Thursday?
Yep.
Thank you.
I close the House Education Committee here.
Close the Healthcare Subcommittee on Health Policy